This is Steve Maxter conducting an interview with Mr. Charles White on the 5th of March, 2003, approximately 1 o'clock Lubbock time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, and Mr. White is in Amarillo, Texas. Sir, first, thanks for consenting to this interview. And why don't we begin with a discussion of your early life, and if you would tell me when and where you were born and where you grew up.
I was born in Slayton, Texas. My parents were actually living in Post, Texas at that time. And I started... Went to first grade in Tahoka, Texas, second grade in Roswell, New Mexico, the rest of my elementary in Portales, New Mexico, and then junior high and high school at USU, Texas.
Okay. So spend most of your time in the Southwest, or all your life in the Southwest.
Yeah, in the flat, boring plains, as we frequently call them. Mm-hmm. And then, you want me to continue on that background?
Yes, sir.
And then I went to Texas Tech University, mm-hmm. where I majored in accounting, and I graduated from there in 3 years, mm-hmm. and then worked in accounting for, let's see, 3 years, where I became a CPA, and then that's when the Vietnam War was coming on,
okay.
and then... I had always wanted to, you know, I think all young men have a yearning to be in the military in a way, and so this was my excuse to get my military tab. And so I was assured an OCS class, and then mm-hmm. by going into the Army, I went into the regular Army basic enlisted training, regular Army what they call advanced individual training, and then started my OCS class in the summer of 1966.
Okay. No, while you were growing up, let's go ahead and take a few moments and explore some aspects of your experiences as a young person. Did you have, what kind of jobs did you have growing up, especially, for instance, in junior high and high school? Did you
work? My dad was a lineman for Southwestern Public Service Company.
Okay.
And so I began wiring houses part-time and was an electrical contractor by the time I was a senior in high school.
Wow.
And so I worked my way through college doing that type of work, which mm-hmm. was a pretty good deal because it paid a little bit more than the menial jobs most college students have.
Yes, sir. And also, while you were in school, high school in particular, did you enjoy any particular sports, play sports for school teams?
Oh, baseball, football. And even band.
Okay.
But the baseball was my real love.
Okay. Did you continue that into your college experience, or?
No, I couldn't find time for it. But as a young child, I was a Mickey Mantle fan.
Okay. Now, you mentioned what your father did. What about your mom? Was she a homemaker, or did she do work?
She worked in a CPA office.
Okay. And what subjects did you like as you were growing up?
In high school?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, English, history, science, drama, most of them.
Mm-hmm. You didn't mention math here.
We didn't have a very good math program. I liked it, but we didn't have much of a math program at
okay.
USU.
Well, that struck
us. We had weak instructors in that, so.
Oh, I see. It only struck me because you later went on to be an accountant, so I thought you might have an affection for numbers.
Well, no, that was my mother's influence, but I didn't stay an accountant, so that should tell you how well I loved it.
True. I guess for the record now, you're a lawyer. You're an attorney.
Yeah, so I still pay the accounting fee to keep it alive, but I hadn't practiced since I became a lawyer.
Okay. Well, what made you choose on Texas Tech University?
Well, I had grown up in USU, and that's the big school in our area, and that would be the reason.
Okay.
And that was the year that it came out in the paper that, I think, somewhere about that time, that the Lubbock Avalanche Journal was Tech is in. That means when they were admitted to Southwest Conference.
Oh, okay.
And that was a big deal then.
Right. Okay. Well, you graduated from Tech in around, what, 62, 63?
62. I would have ordinarily graduated in 63, but I went three straight summers and finished in 62.
Okay. And as an accountant, did you work here in Texas again or someplace else?
Yeah, it was in the Dallas-Fort Worth area.
Okay. Now, after you graduated and you were working as an accountant, in particular, I guess, during your time as an accountant in Dallas-Fort Worth, what do you remember about some of the key events leading up to the Vietnam War, in particular, the Gulf of Tonkin incidents in 1964, Johnson's decisions to escort.
Right. Remember all of that.
You do? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I thought, like most of the public then, you know, I remember it wasn't too many years before that when Khrushchev pounded his shoe on the table and said, "We'll bury you."
Mm-hmm.
So I think most of the citizenry really believed in the domino effect.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, I might ask, what is your age bracket? So I kind of know how to read.
Oh, sure, I'm 37.
Okay, well, that would be a little before your time on that.
Yeah. I was born the year before you went to Vietnam.
Okay, but you probably read about Khrushchev's antics.
Yes, sir. Well,
and that was probably one of the most horrible misselection of words in history.
Mm-hmm. Did you follow politics, or were politics discussed very much in your home? Did your parents talk about politics at the dinner table?
Oh, some. My mother grew up in a family that where Roosevelt was a hero.
Mm-hmm.
And my father grew up in a family where Roosevelt was a non-hero.
Okay.
My mother was a Democrat, my father was a Republican.
Okay.
But their parents were both in the same occupation, which was farming.
Hmm. Now, did your father, did he serve in World War II?
No, he did not.
Did you have any relatives or uncles? Or?
Yes, I have one uncle. Mm-hmm. That was a glider pilot.
Mm-hmm.
That was involved in the Normandy invasions.
Wow.
And he's still alive, living in Lubbock.
Is he really?
Yes.
Well, that's great. So he must be aware of the Silent Wings project here.
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay.
Yes.
So he talked to you a lot about his experiences?
I've always questioned him as much as possible. And my experience on these old World War II guys, people say they wouldn't talk to you, and that's baloney. If you were truly inquisitive.
Mm-hmm.
I never had one to refuse to talk to me.
Okay.
And I interviewed even several Death March veterans. And they, you know, nobody can ever compare in the hardships they had.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day and time after having visited those, I just, because of that experience of talking to those guys, I've never had sympathy for whiners.
Mm-hmm. Well, in your upbringing, and as you were growing up, in your teenage years in particular, while you were in junior high and high school, how much do you remember about the Cold War and fear of the Soviets having the bomb?
I followed that quite closely, mm-hmm. but I don't think that it generated the fear that some people believe it did. Of course, mm-hmm. living in Muleshoe, you felt relatively safe from an attack.
Mm-hmm.
And probably that's why we would not have had that type of fear.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember having any kind of drills or anything?
No.
You know, the duck and cover drill, that kind of stuff?
No.
Okay. Okay. How about tornado drills? Did they
yes.
start just doing those yet?
Well, they had. Yeah, they did.
Okay.
A little.
Uh-huh. Okay. And
that was not too much before
mm-hmm.
the big Lubbock tornado.
Right. When they took down downtown.
Yeah.
What did you do for recreation growing up in the Southwest and New Mexico and Texas?
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, in high school, we were pretty active juveniles. I was really a good kid, but that was during the days when we could go out in the sand hills and practice our demolitions and invite the public. Nobody thought anything about it. That's how times have changed. If you see what I'm talking about.
Oh, yes, sir. Now, by demolitions, do you mean fireworks or firearms?
No, build bombs and stuff, blow up sand hills. But, I mean, you know, that was all we did.
Uh-huh.
You know what I'm saying? There's,
yes, sir.
It was more of a science-type interest than using farm chemicals and things like that.
Mm-hmm. What would you use?
Oh, let me see. We built stuff out of sodium chlorate, and then we'd use various forms of carbon and sulfur and all that. Car batteries and flashlight bulb attachments for igniters and all that.
These are real bombs.
Yeah. But the thing about it is it shows how times have changed. That was harmless, juvenile experimentation that was basically not frowned on by the adult world because there was no malicious intent or activity. It was more scientific.
Mm-hmm. That is interesting.
Yeah.
Now, how large of a bomb could you make?
Oh, we didn't get any big time stuff, you know, like a little 4-inch diameter, maybe a foot long time.
Okay. What else did you do besides make bombs?
Well, let me see. Halloweens were terrible back then, which I really hated.
Okay.
Kids were malicious on Halloween back then.
How so?
Oh, gosh. Dump everybody's trash in town, litter Main Street terribly, and it was tired. That's one improvement society has certainly gone through.
Okay.
And this was always Texas Tales. And even it went way back to when my dad was in high school. He described the same type of conduct. But, you know, the schools certainly provided enough activities. Now, I would guess as a child, the pride of my life was being Little League baseball.
Okay.
As a young child.
What position did you play?
I was a pitcher.
Okay.
I was a guy, pretty healthy guy. I wasn't all that good, and there was a World War II veteran that had his career ruined because of the shot at knee. And he literally gave me private lessons for 3 years, and we won state 1 year. This was at Portales at the time. Won state, though, 2 years.
Wow.
And, so that was fun times for a boy.
Yes, sir. So he taught you all the
yeah, he taught me how to pitch.
The different pitches.
Yeah. By the time I got to college and all that, working and all that, I guess you'd say I abandoned that line of enthusiasm. But, let me see, another area, scuba diving. We built my first rig, was a homemade rig, and made it 14. Made out of an automobile compressor and one of those filling station hoses, you know what I'm talking about?
Yes, sir.
And we go diving in the lakes in New Mexico, up to 50 feet going down.
Wow.
Since learned that's terribly dangerous.
Yes, sir.
But then ultimately, by the time I was in high school, I got me a regular diving rig. And then when I was in college, we'd go dive for bodies because back then fire departments didn't have any diving gear. And so, as a boy, that was an adventuresome activity.
Yes, sir. And now, where would you dive in college to help find bodies?
Well, let me see. In the Playa Lakes.
In the Playa Lakes? Okay.
In the Playa Lakes. Back then, you'd have a kid drowning about every year in the Playa Lake.
Oh.
And either they've learned how to swim or they've gotten smart.
Well, they I don't think they allow any swimming in them anymore.
Well, and, I mean, I'm talking about rural Playa Lakes, usually.
Oh, the rural?
Yeah.
Okay, so outside the city limits of Lubbock.
Yeah, but they'd always call a Lubbock
civil
defense or fire department to come help them.
Okay.
But I remember back then you'd have the Salvation Army and Red Cross bringing coffee and all that.
Mm-hmm.
That was an adventure for a young man.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm still a volunteer fireman.
And potentially gruesome experience for a young man.
Yes, because I remember one time we did find a body in the water so murky you just do hand feeling until you come across it.
Oh, goodness. And it was a child?
What?
It was a child?
It was probably a 13, 14-year-old boy.
Oh, goodness. What kind of effect did that have on you?
I still remember it, but, I mean, it's nothing.
It didn't disturb you too badly?
No. As far as real effects on what disturbs you, I'll tell you that later.
Okay. Yeah, well, probably more like Vietnam. What happened
in
Vietnam?
And actually, one of the more disturbing was a Fort Sill accident.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Was that during training?
Yes.
Okay.
So we only had a couple of guys burned up.
Okay. Well, when you were playing with explosives, were there any accidents with any of your friends?
No.
Okay,
no,
that's
we
good.
We were careful.
Yeah, I'd imagine so.
We used long wire and all that.
Long wires.
Yes, long wire.
Okay. What about movies, television?
When I was a kid, going way back, daughters. I'm glad they disappeared by the time they came along.
Uh-huh. Okay. Any particular types of movies you enjoyed more than others?
Oh, probably the same ones we all watch today, westerns and mm-hmm. action movies.
Okay. What about the good World War II genre films that were...
The documentaries or the...
No, the actual Hollywood films.
Yeah, I still watch
Sands of Iwo Jima, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I still watch reruns on those. Those are good. Mm-hmm. And then I particularly enjoy watching the documentaries. Mm-hmm.
But did you enjoy those as a young person as much?
Yes.
Okay. And let's see. What about, Friday night, other Friday night activities for young people where you were growing up? I don't know if calling it a sock hop would be an appropriate expression, but...
In the town where I was, back then, dancing was a sin.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You may be a Baptist, but it's a Baptist.
You're not joking, are you? Serious.
I'm serious.
Yeah, you could not. You're not allowed to dance.
That's right.
Yeah.
But you could have private dances, of course,
uh-huh.
and the non-Baptist did.
Okay.
And, with just basically back then, dragging Maine in those small towns was a mm-hmm. very popular, wasteful pastime.
Did you have a car?
I did.
Mm-hmm. What kind of was it?
I got a pickup truck.
Okay. Okay.
And because of my work, I had a pickup truck. But then, like today, a lot of guys back then had pickup trucks, too. Yeah. Whether they needed them or not.
As you were growing up, you mentioned that your grandparents were farmers.
Yes.
Did they still have the farm, and did you spend very much time on it, if they did?
Yes, I did, and truly enjoyed that.
Were you able to actually help with running the farm sometimes, or was it just the visit?
Oh, I'd go there in the summers, mm-hmm. But that's as a younger boy, and, as a younger boy, you're not very much worth as an employee, although you think you are.
Yeah.
And then by the time I got to be a teenager, I was already had my summer jobs and all that, so
mm-hmm.
didn't get to spend as much time at the farm.
Yeah. What kind of farming did they do?
Mainly cotton.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
They're both in South Lubbock and Linn County.
Okay. And let's see. Well, when you hear a Texas Tech, and as in terms of the Cold War atmosphere, what was the attitude of most of the students like? What was the atmosphere here like with regard to the war on communism?
Oh, I'd say pretty much Texas Tech was pretty darn conservative. And I remember going to Austin during the football game during that time, and it was a totally different world. You'd have the pre-hippies, the pre-advanced hippies, I guess you'd say.
Mm-hmm.
It was shocking to see that the University of Texas was so different from Texas Tech,
uh-huh.
which was so conservative.
Now, what was it that made them seem or appear so liberal as compared to the conservative?
Oh, their political attitudes, mm-hmm. their dress, mm-hmm. basically the same as what we call the hippies of the 60s.
Okay. You're talking about longer hair?
Longer hair, weird dress, mm-hmm. slovenly look, and then a different political philosophy then. And that's one reason that some legitimate liberals mm-hmm. were defamed because they might be legitimate liberals, but because of the hippie look that adopted their style, it didn't help them a whole lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I'm talking about there.
Mm-hmm. I think so. Well, let's see. The war really didn't kick off until you were living in Dallas-Fort Worth. What was
right.
the attitude and atmosphere like there as compared to, say, Lubbock or Austin?
Dallas-Fort Worth, probably not that much at that time, was not that much different from Lubbock.
Okay.
It would have been about the same.
Okay, so a little more conservative.
What?
A little bit more conservative.
What, Lubbock or Dallas?
In Dallas-Fort Worth as opposed to Austin.
Oh, yeah, as opposed to Austin,
yeah.
definitely.
Okay.
Austin always seemed like a different world.
Mm-hmm. And what did you think about, some of the key, the big Cold War events as you were growing up? Stuff like, what do you remember about Sputnik?
Well, of course, I remember reading about it, and then I think everyone remembers Kennedy's science speech about putting the man on the moon. I didn't believe it at the time, but I'd be danged if they didn't do it. I mean, I didn't believe we could do it, but I guess we did.
And what do you remember about Kennedy's assassination? You were in Dallas at the time.
Yes, I was in Fort Worth. I was in Fort Worth just a few blocks from where he gave his last speech.
My goodness.
And, yeah, that was very traumatic at that time. That was a time when pretty well the country was pretty well united in thought and attitude, the same as, say, September 11th of 2000. You didn't have a conservative-liberal distinction at that point.
Where were you, and what do you remember hearing, and then how did the what was the atmosphere like where you were when you heard that Kennedy had been killed?
Well, I was at work and heard he'd been shot, and then for the next several days we were glued to our television around the clock, somewhat like Desert Storm kickoff in 1990, which I slept on the floor in front of the TV for the first few days. And which, if I know I'm out of order, but Desert Storm restored a proud, to me, restored a proud moment in my life.
With regard?
The country was so united on it.
Yes, sir. And you're talking about with regard to your Vietnam service?
Yes.
Yes, sir. As the days progressed after the announcement that Kennedy had been assassinated, what were things like in Dallas? I mean, this is the place where it happened.
Yeah, and I think Dallas was really apprehensive about that.
Yeah.
And if you remember history, Jack Ruby, the guy that shot Oswald, quickly got the death penalty. And I've always thought that part of the reason on that was, Oswald was supposed to be the villain and everybody wanted to eliminate him. Yet they gave Ruby the death penalty, and I think part of that was Dallas was trying to, always felt like they were trying to rehabilitate their image. I don't know if there's anything to that, but that's how it reflected on me.
Okay. What do you think about some of the this various conspiracy theories that have emerged about the Kennedy assassination?
Oh, I don't think there's any credible evidence of that.
You think it was just Oswald?
Yeah, based on the evidence that I've read and seen.
As events were unfolding and the United States was increasingly becoming involved in Southeast Asia.
Now, well, let me back up on
that. Oh, sure, go ahead.
I always thought there might have been a foreign entity, Cuba or USSR, that might have financed him on some of this material. But beyond that, as far as in the States, I assume he always assumed he acted alone.
Okay. So some kind of external support.
Right.
Well, as events unfolded and the United States became involved in Southeast Asia, what did you think about that? And in particular, the United States was planning on fighting or what eventually found itself fighting a war in an Asian nation, trying to help them fight against communism.
Yeah, I was a real hawk about that, and there's a reason for that. If you think back to World War II, we let Britain take it on the chin for 2 years, which I still think is unforgivable, before we became involved. And ironically, before World War II, it was the Democrats that were the hawks and the Republicans were the doves. And, I mean, that's an absolute fact.
Mm-hmm.
And so knowing that it's inconceivable for us to let what happened for Britain, it's the person who read any history at that time, it was easy to say we should jump in and defend these people. Of course, that's disregarding the fact that I've since read a lot of history which discredits some of the legitimate basis for entering into it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm talking about perspective then.
Oh, right.
Now.
Yeah, that's what we want.
Yeah.
Your perspective at the time. Yeah. Well, what did you think about the contradiction? Or did it concern you that President Johnson got elected in 1964 on a platform that he would not let American boys fight an Asian war, or a war that Asian boys should be fighting for themselves, I think is how he put it.
Yeah.
And then, of course, he sent us in anyway.
Yeah, I know. I didn't think a whole lot about that one way or the other. I do still remember, though, to this day, the campaign ads, which I was initially very favorable toward Goldwater, and those ads that Johnson came out with really sold the public against Goldwater, including me. And so I cast my first vote for LBJ. Remember the one about the nuke, that Goldwater would get us in a war?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, but by the time Johnson decided we need to get in, I just assume, well, times have changed and he's got to take appropriate action.
Okay. Well, you indicated on the, one of the questionnaires you filled out that part of the reason why you volunteered was probably because of the imminent draft.
Yeah, and I think also, as I said, it provided an excuse to, yeah, that's really true.
Yeah, as you stated already, the adventure.
Yes.
What made you choose the Army as opposed to the other branches?
Well, I didn't really want to commit for 4 years, for one thing.
Okay.
And the Army had a readily, right then, available OCS class. When I'd signed up, even though I was a private, already had a class date set for OCS.
Okay. Well, why don't you... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead. I've covered it.
Oh, I was just going to ask you if you would describe your interactions, I guess, with your family as you told them that you were going ahead and voluntarily enlisting, and with Vietnam on the horizon. What was the reaction?
I had a brother went in the Navy about the same time,
mm-hmm.
and I think they just assumed that we were going to be called, and they accepted it. Although I've since learned in later years it bothered my mother a lot more than she had ever expressed.
Why don't you go ahead and describe leaving and going to the Army, where you went for basic training, your first impressions of active duty Army life, all that.
Okay. Well, now, I was married when I went in the Army, my last school teacher.
Oh, okay.
Still same wife. And so I went in Dallas, Texas, and they flew us to Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri. And having been a CPA and a professional, I think I kind of had probably a little bit of an uppity attitude when I was being mixed in with all these enlisted guys, and probably thought I was better than they. But by the time I got through basic training, it's easy to find out that they could do anything I could do as far as that level of activity was, if you know what I'm talking about.
Yes, sir.
And so, anyway, basic training was basically what I expected. Basic training was geared to training the lowest man, so that was pretty dull.
Mm-hmm.
The advanced individual training that I went through were all guys that were already scheduled for an OCS class, so it was a totally different caliber of men. They were all enthusiastic and worked hard. OCS, I had gotten down to a trim 175 after the AEIT. I started OCS, and in 30 days, I'd already dropped another 20 pounds. It was, to me, it was tough.
You went down to 155?
155, yeah.
Wow.
And I'd already been conditioned to 175 and then instantly dropped another 20. They were intending to weed out those that did not have the will or the stamina to serve as an officer. I kept thinking at that time, I know we lost a couple of guys. One was a PhD because they weren't going to put up with it. And I thought to myself, you don't have to practice to learn to be miserable and all that. And then in looking back, I guess an officer should be able to tolerate a lot of stuff to the maximum. And I'm not talking about just physical, but mental and all that, if he's going to lead groups. And so I condone the way they handle that years later more than I did then. So I have no problem with the program. It was a good program.
Okay. Now, during basic training, what was the most challenging aspect for you?
See, I got there in March, and they gave us all our, it's still cold like it is now, mm-hmm. and they gave us all those shots, and I got sick off of that, and it was really rough the first 3 weeks because I was sick. Mm-hmm. If it hadn't been for that, I don't know of anything that would have been particularly challenging, except I thought it moved too slow.
Mm. What weapons were you trained on, basic?
We were trained on... basically, as far as firing weapons, only the rifle.
Okay.
Well, rifle and grenades, hand grenades.
That was the M14?
M14 and hand grenades. Mm-hmm. It's only weapons and in basic. Now, when you went to the higher level, then you start going to other weapons.
In basic, again, how did they enforce discipline? Were there any disciplinary problems with any soldiers going through basic?
You know... strange as it may sound, we didn't have any particular... Well, I think back then, when you went in as a private E. Nothing, you saw somebody wearing two stripes as a big deal, and everybody pretty well obeyed, stepped in line, and I didn't see much of a discipline problem.
Okay. And what was the ethnic...
Now, keep in mind that I'm there in 66, which
right.
is 5 years ahead of... 1971 when they were really having problems.
Mm-hmm.
So I think politically probably things did change later on.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you know you were going to Vietnam while you were going through basic?
They were telling us that.
Okay.
Now, I was married and I thought, well, you know, it'd be kind of my wife wanted me to end up in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
And you know how this is. You say, I'd like to go to Southeast Asia, but common sense tells me you don't volunteer for it.
Right.
And so when I got out of OCS, I had orders to be either Korea or Vietnam, and then I called in on the hotline, said send me to Vietnam if I'm going to be there.
Okay.
Because I wanted the extra pay.
Did your wife know this?
No.
Does she now?
Yes.
Okay. I was going to say.
After about 20 years, I confessed.
Okay. All right. That's a safe cushion at times.
Mm-hmm.
What, again, in basic training, what was the ethnic makeup of your class, your platoon?
We had, I'd say, fairly representative of all races. Mm-hmm. I don't remember seeing many Oriental type, but mm-hmm. we had Hispanics and blacks and all that.
Okay. And everybody seemed to get along all right, or
yeah, I didn't see
any problem.
Okay. The racial problems in the military that they experienced later on just were not there
mm-hmm.
5 years earlier, which is supposed to, historically is supposed to be in the reverse this day and time.
Right. Okay.
But that might have been mm-hmm. just slightly before black power reached its peak,
mm-hmm.
and there was a revolution, which I really felt sorry for the officers later on.
Yeah.
That was a temporary phase in history where they just literally mutinied practically,
right.
and we didn't have that problem back then. Yeah. And we had almost one in my unit, which I'll tell later when you get to that phase.
Right. Let's see. Did you stay there in Fort Leonard Wood was just for basic. Where did you go for AIT?
That was at Fort Sill, and it was in okay. cannoneering and gunnery.
Okay. So artillery?
Yes.
Now, did you sign up for that specifically?
Well, you know, when I went in, they said, you have a choice of armor. They said, you have three choices, armor, infantry, or artillery.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody had made a comment one time, if you're good at math, you'd be good at artillery. And I had no other reason except, you know, big guns is impressive.
Mm-hmm.
So I said, well, just put me down for the artillery.
Okay.
So.
Did you ever regret that choice?
No, I've thoroughly enjoyed artillery,
mm-hmm.
and I remember having the colonel at Fort Sill, when we do training problems, mm-hmm. would say he had rather do an artillery field problem than play a round of golf any day.
Mm-hmm.
And I can kind of see his basis for it. There was a lot of excitement in it.
Mm. Okay. What was the most challenging aspect of your artillery advanced training?
Of the training
mm-hmm.
at Fort Sill?
Yes, sir.
Oh, It was fascinating to learn the science of artillery and all that. And then, of course, there was a lot of good physical conditioning in that program. It's called AIT, which I'm sure you're thoroughly familiar with that by now. And there was a lot of physical conditioning, but they had a lot of good technical training then, because it's a different group. You had, before we were bored because it's moving so slow, now you had to work. Okay. You had to work at it for the first time because it was moving faster in a different group.
And I would imagine a lot more classroom time.
And what?
Was there more classroom time in artillery AIT?
Yes. Okay. And but I mean, there's still, but we still had the outdoor material, but there was a lot of classroom time too.
What artillery pieces and weapon systems were you trained on in artillery AIT?
At Fort Sill?
Mm-hmm.
The 105 and the 155.
Okay.
Which both are still in the U.S. arsenal, by the way.
Yes, sir. Any problems?
Now, the bigger guns have been done away with, in case you didn't know it.
I beg your pardon?
The bigger artillery bases have been eliminated completely. On-field artillery.
Were there any training accidents or problems in at Fort Sill?
After, not in this stage of advanced individual training or OCS.
Okay.
After I got out of OCS, I was assigned to Fort Sill for 9 months, I believe it was, and to a unit, and that's when we had when we were a field unit that trained troops.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we had that accident I mentioned earlier.
Okay.
And I may have described that in my statement. I just can't remember how much detail I gave you on it.
I do remember reading a little bit about it. But
yeah.
Why don't you go ahead and this seems like a logical enough place for it. Why don't you describe what happened? I assume that you were providing support. Your unit was providing support for AIT or OCS units,
right,
like yourself.
Right. Uh-huh. And we would work from early in the morning till late at night.
Mm-hmm.
And we were coming in from the field after shooting all day and into the evening. And on the artillery rounds, they're designed with increments of powder charges. And if you're shooting the shorter distances, they pull out some of the powder and it's to be destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
So it comes in bags. Like on 105, it has 8 bags. And if you're shooting a certain range increment, you take out, say, the top 3 bags. So then after the end of the day, because it's so dangerous and explosive, you've got to go burn it somewhere. And that's the safest way is to dispose of it. Well, there was a neighboring truck that had a new lieutenant that was hauling it. And there's a pick, and they're hauling it, and I look beyond me, and there's a Jeep towing an ammo trailer. It's completely ablaze. And then I see 3 bodies jump out of it running totally aflame. So I get there, and by the time I got there, I had a buck hunting knife with me. I always carried it. And I remember by the time I got to this guy, all of his clothes were burned off. All that was left was his charring shorts and his boots, and he was screaming, at that time, "My balls, my balls." And so I cut his underwear off, cut his boots off, and I remember his skin on his arm fell off backwards like pulling off a rubber glove. And he was burned just terribly, and then waiting for them to pick him up, take him in. That's pretty gruesome.
Yes, sir.
And so, and that being my first exposure to an instrument like that, you remember those things pretty well.
Yes, sir.
And so, and fire is a pretty bad way to go, and then I remember he starts screaming for water. He wanted water and all that. And that's one of the first complaints of a serious burn is instant dehydration. And so anyway, he was shipped off immediately to San Antonio. Another one, not burned so badly, was kept there and treated at SEAL. And the third one, he wasn't burned as bad either, and they kept him at SEAL. I do remember during that time I was trying to take care of the situation, and one of these young lieutenants, who I thought should have never been a lieutenant, was running around while we're trying to take care of the problem, screaming, "Will I lose my commission? Will I lose my commission?" He was more concerned about his commission than taking care of what had happened. And I always remember that guy, but I don't remember his name. He probably ended up in Kelly's unit or something.
What happened? How did the first gentleman that was burned so badly, did he survive?
I'm sure he died. The other two survived.
My goodness.
But they were in a truck full of powder that just exploded.
Any idea how it happened?
No, I don't know that it's ever established. Probably somebody was smoking, but you never know. That goes down on the battalion commander's record and probably blocks his advancement, even though, you know, some things they have no control over. However, a battalion commander could have had a safety program that he could have enforced that would have prohibited that, really, in reality.
Okay. Well, that's, it doesn't sound like it could get much worse in terms of a training accident.
Yeah, that's about as good of a bad of a training accident as you can have.
Yeah. So anything that did happen in basic, your AIT or OCS, I'm sure pales in comparison.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have minor scratches. I do remember in basic training, a sergeant decided to take the cover off the bayonet for bayonet training, and then he did I think they called it a block and parry, and caught the knife right in his hand. It just sliced his hand open. He's sitting there with egg on his face.
Oh, yeah.
And thought that was somewhat of a stupidity because they weren't supposed to be taking them off to do that, but he wanted to give a real live demonstration.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't work. But that's only accidents I remember.
Mm-hmm. Now, were many of your instructors Vietnam War veterans? Have they been over and back yet?
A few, but not many.
Okay.
Because, you know, at that point in time, there hadn't been that many. Mm-hmm. In 66. We'd only been there in that time in less than a year, maybe a year.
Okay. And what about Vietnam-specific training? Things, you know, mock villages or anything like that. Did they set up anything like that for your training?
Not in basic or AIT. We did some of that in OCS, and then they had given the officers and some enlisted men from all services the opportunity to go to the jungle school at Panama. I think I have that on the questionnaire, don't I?
Mm-hmm.
I went down there, and they had the mock villages, and it was called Jungle Warfare School.
Right.
And having grown up on the plains, I thoroughly enjoyed that school.
Mm.
You know, if you saw Tarzan movies as a kid, that ought to be fun.
Yeah.
And so we had a lot of pretty good training down there.
Okay.
And that counted as a part of the tour.
Now, did you, after you finished OCS, you went on to artillery infantry basic course, yes? I mean, artillery basic course for officers.
No. Well, at that time, the artillery course, OCS, was a 26-week course, which included the basic course built into it.
Oh, okay. All right.
So, in other words, it was like more than twice as long as the Marine course or the Navy or the Air Force. But the reason it was twice as long is because they had the basic built into it.
Right. Now, what was the attrition rate in your OCS artillery class? Do you remember?
I know we had some attrition, and most of it happened early, and most of it was because of the ones that weren't going to suffer through the indignities.
Oh, I see.
And then as you went along, for those that had effeminate traits, they seldom survived because they were peer rated and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So you had a few of those. Most all of those types were eliminated on peer review.
Okay.
And probably not a bad idea when you're considering that you're talking about a man that's going to be in charge of men
right. In
combat conditions.
Right.
But for the ones that stuck past the first month, they was a pretty salty bunch. And the attrition rate was not too bad.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I think if they hadn't needed officers as bad as they do it, they could have made it higher.
Mm-hmm.
Or
could
have just screened out more academics or whatever, you know what I'm talking about, if they could have just made the academic requirements higher.
Now, when did you graduate from Artillery OCS?
In January 31, 1967,
okay.
I put on second lieutenant's bars that day.
Okay.
They give you a discharge as an enlisted man, E5,
right.
And the same time you put on lieutenant's bars, okay. O1.
Now,
and as strange as it was, here I am with CPA.
Mm-hmm.
60, that'd be 67. I was still 25 years old. I would have turned 26 later. But here I am, 25 years old, CPA and all that. And that was one of the proudest days of my life, being the second lieutenant. And I don't know why it just was. It was impressive.
At this point, were you accompanied by your wife? Was she with you there?
By that time, she had moved up there. She moved up there alone, and I didn't even know she was moving. Okay. And she and some other wives lived together. Okay. I might mention, toward the end of artillery, you'll see, yes, I was offered a direct commission in the finance corps. And, you know, by that time, I said, hell no, man, I'm a trained artilleryman. Went through too much trouble to this just to get a finance corps commission. And there were other guys like that, too. And I might mention, you know, Tommy Franks,
general.
The general,
yes,
was in charge of the, well, all
South,
of the
Southcom commander.
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
He was 2 weeks behind me in OCS.
Well, I see. Okay.
Yeah. Artillery OCS at Fort Sill.
Now, did you already know when you graduated from Artillery OCS what your next assignment would be?
The day we graduated, we got it. There was a class of 112, or maybe it was 122. And most of them, over 100, had orders to Germany, and about a dozen of us had orders to, called an unaccompanied Southeast Asia tour, which meant Korea or Vietnam. So we got the orders that day, but it's, but you've had to be assigned to a stateside unit for a period of time before you go over.
Okay. And this is when you received your assignment to work there at Fort Sill with the training units.
Yeah. Okay. Which is compared to Marine Corps artillery officers, I thought we were much better prepared because we had longer, almost twice the training term, and had to be assigned to a unit of at least 6 months before we went overseas. I think theirs was a 90-day assignment before they went over. And mine actually ended up being February through November, stateside. And that training, which was shooting nearly all the time every day, was invaluable.
Okay. Now, what was your preference in terms of the artillery pieces available to you?
In terms of what?
In terms of the artillery pieces that were in use at the time and available to you, which was your favorite gun?
Well, at Fort Sill, it would be the 105 because it was so much faster and maneuverable.
Okay.
The 155 is just heavier. And the 105, they had the new, what they called an airborne liftable one, and that they used in Vietnam, plus the standard towed, which the one they used in World War II is basically the, almost the same today. And if I can divert just a minute,
sure.
I finished reading a book called The Battle of Dien Bien Phu. The artillery pieces that the Vietnamese used to wipe out the French, you've heard of the Battle of Dien Bien Phu.
Yes, sir.
Were mainly U.S. 105s that were captured in Korea. And I never knew that until I read the book. And while I'm on that topic, the 175s that we fired in Vietnam, they did not keep a single one for historical purposes in the U.S. However, Vietnam did keep one polished up for us in Hanoi and one in Saigon and one in Hue. Kept three of them. But we gave all of ours to Iraq.
Ironic, huh?
Isn't it, though? we gave most. I think Israel got a few, but Iraq got most of them because at that time they were trying to put them somewhere, and the U.S. had taken them out of their active arsenal and replaced them with rockets for the longer-range artillery.
Okay. Well,
now, when I got over there with 175s, there is something exciting about a 175 gun that'll fire 21 miles.
Okay.
It makes a bigger boom.
Yeah, yeah. That range factor, standoff.
And you consider that we wore out, during the four-year period, the battalion wore out over 1,000 gun tubes.
Did you really?
That's a lot of firing.
Yes, sir, it is. Now, how many rounds typically through the tube until it has to be replaced?
Well, at that time, they could not. They started out, they were going to run 900 through them, and then they had a few gun explosions. They lowered that down to 300 for a while, and they raised it back up to 400, and Now, that's on maximum charge, if you shoot maximum distance.
Okay.
If you're shooting the middle charge for shorter distances, then it could go up to a couple of thousand rounds. And so, but most of our calls were for long-range artillery. And so we could change the barrel out. We could be changing the tube out of one and firing the others. And so it was almost nonstop firing during that time.
How long would it take you to switch out a barrel of 175?
They got to where they could do it in as short as 2 hours.
Wow.
But typically, you better say four.
Okay. Now, were there any other interesting...
I mean, they do it on site, too. They wouldn't have to take it back anywhere.
Right, right. Do it right there where the battery was firing.
Right.
Was there anything, any of the stories from training or during your time working with the training units at Fort Sill before you went to Panama?
Were there any stories of what?
Any stories or anything you wanted to discuss about that period of your training?
Oh, the training period?
Right.
No. Fort Sill is a pleasant memory and experience for me. Mm-hmm. And my wife and I went back for the first time to a battalion reunion.
Hmm.
In the year 2000, and that was the first time I'd ever been back.
Okay.
And so it was an exciting time because most of us had never even talked to anybody from the battalion for over 30 years, and then suddenly you're meeting all these men, which I have a story about that.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably not the right place to tell it. So I need to cover it an hour later.
Well, are these guys that you served with there in the battalion, or these people that you served with in Vietnam?
In Vietnam.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let's talk about that after we talk about Vietnam, as a post-war perspective.
Right.
Yeah. What about, okay, so when you were going through your, I guess, was it 6 months that you were at Fort Sill working with the training units?
9 months.
9 months. During that nine-month period, you knew at the end of that 9 months you'd be going to Vietnam.
Yes.
Okay. What was your wife's reaction to that?
Well, she's a real trooper.
Okay, good.
She wanted to go to Germany so she could be with me, but she was a real trooper. She was teaching at Lawton, had gotten a teaching job, and which was lucky because most servicemen's wives didn't get anything.
Mm-hmm.
And then she moved back and started teaching in Dallas. I left her at the airport at Lawton, Oklahoma, and I went to Vietnam. She went to Dallas.
Okay.
But the Army did at that time pay for her move. Being an officer's wife, that's another advantage of being an officer.
And what were your first impressions of getting into Panama and going for your jungle training there?
Oh, man. You know, as a kid that grows up in Texas where you don't see many trees, right. Our part of the state. Right. By the way, are you from this area originally?
No, I'm a Yankee. I'm a transplant Yankee from Boston.
Well, you have a pretty neutral accent.
Yes, I do.
But I ask you if you're from Lubbock. You know?
Right.
Because my uncle, the glider pilot in Lubbock,
yes, sir?
Is from Boston, and he still parks the car.
Oh, no.
After all these years, he's from Boston. And he came to Lubbock as a young man because it'd be after World War II. And he never lost his accent.
That's funny.
Anyway, I interrupted you, and I got off topic, and I forgot where I was.
Just when you went down to Panama for your survival training?
Yes.
If you would, go ahead and describe that. You wrote a story, a very humorous story, about some of the things that you experienced there.
Did you read it?
Yes, sir. So I thought it would be appropriate for you to share that, too, on the interview.
Yeah. A lot of guys hated Panama, but I just thought it was so damn much fun. And, you know, we were down there with Air Force guys, Navy SEALs and everything, and it's just a fantastic experience. And they worked as hard. But being so different and in such a different environment, maybe if you'd have been from a place that had a lot of vegetation, you might not have appreciated it as much as I did. But it was a thoroughly enjoyable experience. We'd rappel down waterfalls and build rafts to go across the Chagres River, which is a huge velocity, or not velocity, but volume river,
mm-hmm.
that actually feeds the canal and fills the locks.
Mm-hmm.
And hacking through the jungle with machetes and all that, and also knowing that nobody's shooting at you, made it very fun. If somebody had been shooting at us while we were hacking through the jungle. No, it would not have been fun.
Well, the only time people were shooting at you in Panama were with BB guns, right?
Yes,
Okay.
That was not an everyday deal. That was just a couple of days.
Okay. Well, what was why don't you go ahead and describe one of those first experiences you had? I guess you said it was the first night of training, where you hadn't been issued any kind of jungle boots or anything yet.
Yeah, we were still issued those slick, old, regular Army-issue boots.
Mm-hmm.
And I literally did slide in the mud off of a mountain in one of the night exercises. And literally tore my trousers off. And the part about the guide, as I was leaving, a guide going to OCS with had finished his jungle training. He says, "Don't wear underwear, and you won't get heat rash."
Mm-hmm.
Sounded logical to me, and I really regretted that. I never went without it after that.
So you did wear underwear.
All the guys thought that was hilarious.
Uh-huh. And you wore underwear after that?
Oh yes, oh. Never missed it again. Never again.
Okay. Well, how long did you have to wait to get new trousers?
Well, we were there a week, and it came in, and before we went out the next week, I got new trousers.
All right. Oh, that's funny.
We'd come in on Saturday afternoons, So anyway, it was a week in the jungle.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is the October time frame?
That would have been in December.
December?
Late November, early December, somewhere in that time frame.
Of 67.
Oh, yeah, 67. And one thing I remember about Panama is that was some of the coldest times I ever spent in my life was in Panama because it rained all the time, and you'd be soaking wet at night and sleep out there at night soaking wet, and it'd get cold.
Okay. Now, what this was, you said it was only a week long.
No, it was two weeks.
2 weeks long, two-week-long training.
Yeah.
And what were the most challenging aspects for you?
Of the Panama?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, let me see. The escape and evasion was challenging because we all wanted to win, and hacking and trying to go across the streams and navigate and all that. That was a real challenging event.
Mm-hmm.
It was one that everyone wanted to excel at to try to get a chance at the winning, as you noted in the story, the Navy SEALs cheat, and they still didn't win.
Well, what was the relationship like between the Army guys and the other services? And was there a lot of rivalry?
In Vietnam or down there?
No, down in Panama, it's rival school.
Oh, no, it's we got along well.
Okay.
We got along well. Where I was, we had to get along well in Vietnam, too.
And was this a mixed course, or was it all officers?
No, it had NCOs and officers.
Okay.
The highest rank I saw was a lieutenant colonel. Lowest rank I saw was a sergeant E5. And there was E5s, E6s, E7s.
Now, how useful was that training?
That was one of the more useful ones. I do remember we were doing the search and destroy, where you go into their villages and threaten the people with harm if they don't give you the information and all that. And I relate this in the context of the William Kelly deal, because when we were going through that, even though they were talking about it, it was always that any harm you were going to bring to them was a bluff, not to kill them. So I remember that particular deal, and if someone was in an infantry unit doing search and destroy, that would have been certainly pertinent. There was some training on living off the land, and we had samplings of snake, turtle, and shark, and all that, but in a two-week course, you only get so much of that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there wasn't enough time for any lengthy training on it.
Mm-hmm.
There was some brief training on getting water and emergency supply of water and things like that, which would be useful anywhere in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And for a lot of survival things, it had a good use anywhere, whether you're a Boy Scout or whatever.
Mm-hmm. Were there any training accidents down there in Panama?
No.
Okay.
Oh, and you know, blisters.
Well, yeah. And how about run-ins with animals, snakes in particular?
Anything? Well, my story talks about that one of the black palm snake, does it not?
Well, that's the plant, though.
But we didn't know that. Can you imagine you've never been in a swamp before and you're in a jungle at night walking through those things?
Right.
And you get stuck in the foot by one, or in the leg, and you think you've been bit. It was an eerie feeling, though, if you've never done that before, walking in a swamp at night in a foreign land like that.
Yes, sir. So that was in the story you explained the joke behind that. That
yeah.
All the new guys would be told that there were the black palm.
Right.
But actually, it was just the palm plant.
Palm plant that has thorns everywhere.
Right. But anything involving real snakes.
Well, we saw real snakes, and we saw. I didn't know iguanas were in trees down there. They're everywhere.
Okay.
And that surprised me a little bit. We did see some small alligators, but mainly. The iguanas is what surprised me. We'd see wild bananas, iguanas. Of course, that's vegetation, but I just happened to think that.
Well, were you taught to eat that kind of stuff?
Were we what?
Were you taught to eat it?
Yeah, we had samplings of it. They weren't going to have wholesale slaughter of iguanas for, you know. So it was a controlled kill so that they wouldn't just... What I thought, they protected their environment pretty good down there, although it would replace itself in a couple of weeks anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But let me see. I remember seeing a sloth. You ever been around a sloth?
No. Well, only in a zoo.
Well, they had sloths down there, and I remember one night one fell out of a tree on.
On you?
Not on me, but on some of the neighboring guys. It's the biggest racket. And the sloth hisses, has a big old hissing sound and all that. It was a comical almost. Once we found out what the heck it was. There were other animals. I just can't remember what all I saw.
Right.
It's a fascinating place. I'd like to go back to it someday.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, when you left there, did you feel like the military had prepared you as well as you possibly could be for Vietnam?
Yeah. Later on, there's one area for artillerymen I thought they fell a little short on.
What was that?
And that was on small arms trainings. We needed more infantry types training.
Oh, okay.
Because, see, in Vietnam, a lot of people don't know it, but the artillery units are always stuck on the front lines.
Mm-hmm.
Not at the back, on the very front. Mm-hmm. And the reason is because of the noise and concussion and everything else. And you guard your own perimeters. Or if you're at a firing position, lots of times we'd be at a fire base, you'd be assigned a sector of the perimeter. If you move out to an isolated firing position, you're still on the outside.
Mm-hmm.
And, I remember when we were talking about preparation, especially on our enlisted guys. I remember I had one night and I had a new enlisted man there, and I said, "How come you don't have the belt hooked up on your machine gun?" He says, "Nobody ever showed me how to do it." And here he is assigned a perimeter defense M60 machine gun. Now, we'd gotten that training in OCS.
Mm-hmm.
I always thought we could have had a little bit more, but we did have basic exposure to all of the weapons. And we would train ourselves there, and so probably... when we had opportunities, we'd do our own training, and I guess that's maybe the infantry did it that way too. If they only had 8 weeks of officer basic, they couldn't have been putting a lot of it into it. And then I remember on Claymore Mines, I remember asking one of the young men, I said, "How come you haven't plugged the wires in yet?" And he says, "What's into your Claymores?" He says, "What's that?"
No.
I'm not kidding you one bit. It was scary. And so we worked hard to get our guys trained, but you can imagine if you didn't pay attention to those type of details, it could be just devastating.
Yes, sir. When you
put it another way, the officers were pretty well trained. The enlisted men, there were some real shortcomings for cannoneers.
Mm-hmm.
They were trained in cannons, but they were not trained well enough in the other areas.
Did you know what unit you'd be assigned to when you left Panama en route to Vietnam?
Yes, I had one, but they diverted me to a different one when I got there. I was assigned to one is in Tu Corps on the coast, a place called Tu Hoa, but they changed it to, I didn't even find out where I was going until a plane just kept staying up in the air forever. I said, "Where are we going?" It said, "Dong Hai." I said, "Where are they?" I said, "There's the DMZ."
Okay. Yeah, it's a little bit further north.
Yeah.
Well, we've been talking for a little over an hour. Let's take a quick break.
Okay.
All right, we're back. back from our break. Sir, why don't we go ahead and talk about the trip over. If you would describe me what it was like on the aircraft, the atmosphere, the attitude of the people that were sitting around you.
Okay. Left out from Fort Lewis, Washington. On the way over, I think we stopped at Guam for refueling and landed at, I believe it was Cameron Bay. And somewhere, okay, yeah, and I think it was a either Flying Tiger Airlines or Northwest Orient. It was one of those two. And it wasn't anything unusual, but you got flight somewhere. So I really never thought much about it. I don't have any specific remembrances.
Okay. Was it a somber attitude? Was it? Do you remember?
Oh, not particularly.
Okay. Well, what were your first impressions upon arriving in Vietnam?
Well, the Cameron Bay area has all been cleared out, so it would look a whole lot different from Lubbock. That area, well, I was surprised that, you know, you read about it and that you think that that's an uncivilized, undeveloped country, and you get there in Saigon, which is close to Saigon, just like any other major city. I guess that was surprising me a little bit. I knew it wasn't all wilderness there, but when you see it real live, that it's just like the U.S., it's a little bit of a surprise. And then that's where you get processed in and get your assignments and sent to your unit. You get your, I think we had a basic issue of uniforms there. The jungle clothes, jungle boots, and all that. Finally got real jungle boots in. And so that was a day or two, and then we were assigned to our unit. So don't have a lot to say about the processing center. It's pretty routine.
Did you receive any kind of briefings in those first stages of processing through?
Not anything real significant. I'm of the impression that that was usually done on a unit basis or a division basis. I know a lot of divisions would have orienting sessions and all that for a week or so. We were attached to the Marine Brigade, so we really didn't get oriented by anybody except our own battalion.
Okay. When you finished the initial processing and went on to your assignment, why don't you go ahead and describe that process, where you went, and your first impressions of your unit.
Okay, well, let me see. We arrived at Dong Ha, and this was right about 3 weeks preceding Tet of 68.
Okay.
And they'd already started shelling Dong Ha pretty regularly. They had moved long-range artillery in there. Their guns would only shoot 18,000 meters.
Okay.
No, 18 miles. That'd make it about getting close to like 28,000 meters. And so they were hitting they could hit the landing strip near where Dong Ha with that long range guns. And they did up through April.
Okay.
So they were very antsy around the airstrip there when we landed because they didn't want to keep the C-130s sitting there too long. And so we got out, and the units had somebody there to pick us up, and so then we went to our battalion headquarters. And, of course, on the plane, you know, most of them at that point were Marines, and they'd go to their units, and whatever Army artillery had, they'd go to their, they'd be trucked over to their units. So then we get to our battalion headquarters, and then they process us in. And issue the firearms, and then the battalions would have a little orientation. When I got there, they didn't have anything real formal set up. Later on, though, they had some really formal orientation schools. And, in fact, our battalion became the orienting center for the Marine Corps and everybody on artillery up there when they came in country. But that's not while I was there.
Okay. Now, did you, what was your initial assignment, your first assignment?
My initial assignment was what they call a battalion assistant communications officer. And I spent my first 4 months at Dong Han. And really what it amounted to was a utility officer at the beck and call of the battalion commander to go whatever he needed them to do. Mm-hmm. And so as a result of that, I got to go everywhere across the DMZ area and back down to Da Nang and everywhere. And all kinds of assignments. If you read that one, little story about a doggy's trip at sea.
Yes, sir.
That was another example where I'd gone and sent back to Da Nang to pick up something, but I can't remember what the heck it was. And so it was kind of a do-nothing job, but it was really a useful utility officer position for the colonel. Mm-hmm. And so I've got to be at all the locations at one time or other. Just because of that. And then I had some other officer assignment. I did not like my first 4 months up there because nobody ever likes to be at a battalion headquarters unit. Mm-hmm. And then my last month, I went for 8 months, and I went to a firing battery.
Okay.
So
I'm sorry, how long was it?
I was 4 months at Dong Han.
4 months at Dong Han.
Yeah, and that was through, that would have been through... The Battle of Kantian had finished up before I got there.
Okay.
And it's when the battalion got the Presidential Unit Citation Medal, mm-hmm. the Navy Unit Citation,
mm-hmm.
before I got there.
Okay. And this was with 8th Battalion of 4th Artillery?
Yes.
Okay.
They got that before I got there because they were involved in the Battle of Kantian and all
mm-hmm.
that, and supporting all of that.
Right.
And then after I got there, then Ted came over, broke out. And we had got stationed at, a supporting caisson. You read about caisson? Still there?
Oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. I've heard about caisson.
Okay. Well, anyway, we had one battery assigned to one of our firing batteries that was supported to, it was placed at the rock pile and firing for caisson, Camp Carroll in the rock pile.
Okay.
And I was over there, and I have one of my pictures I took over there. It's called Firing into the DMZ. Actually, they were shooting support for caisson from that one.
Mm-hmm.
And during all that time that caisson was being shelled, we have Dong Han, all those locations being shelled at the same time. There is one story that has been corroborated. I was there when the guy was killed. That's a real interesting story, but I've been told what the background behind it was from his battery executive officer, and also last year by the battalion executive officer. We had a guy at the rock pile that would not come out of his bunker and go to guns. He was just overwhelmed with fear of incoming artillery,
mm-hmm.
which is kind of rare. Most of the guys took it pretty good.
Okay.
But he just flat refused, and his battery executive officer said he thought about pulling a patent on him.
Mm-hmm.
They called the medics, but he didn't. He called the medics, and he wouldn't budge. So they sent the battalion executive officer to come over and get him. Tried to talk him into staying. He says, you're not going to be any safer at Dong Han than you are here because we're being sheltered. He said, well, he'd just feel better. So they took him over to Dong Han. And he was killed the next day with incoming artillery.
Oh, for crying out loud.
And that battery where he was with did not have, during the siege of caisson, did not have a single man killed by incoming artillery. They had some killed on road mines and various things, but not by incoming artillery.
Mm.
So that's one of the most ironic stories
mm-hmm.
I've ever heard of.
Yes, sir.
So I was there then the day he was actually killed. Well, four of them died out of it.
Well, when you arrived then in early January, '68,
right?
Several weeks later, Tet kicks off.
Right.
Well, was that? I mean, obviously, it was a surprise from the standpoint of
it was a total surprise. Although everybody knew something was brewing because the shelling had already started pretty
yeah.
much.
Right.
But I remember hearing the news about the Russian-made tanks coming across Lang Bay, and they captured Lang Bay, if you've read that part of the story.
Mm-hmm.
They captured Lang Bay, and I remember we had one battery firing for caisson in Lang Bay, and we have an argument going on. hit, had a direct hit on one of the tanks. But I have a friend that's in the Air Force, from USU, Texas also, by the way, who was flying an F-4 above us, and he says, no, he got that tank with Bob, so I don't know. So we'll never know which one got it, but anyway, the tank, that particular tank was wiped down.
Okay. When you were issued a personal weapon, what did you receive?
Initially received a 45, but those were pretty much useless, so we traded those into an, for an M16 pretty
okay.
quickly.
Okay.
I mean, if you're going to need one, you don't want something that. And I'll tell you why the 45 wasn't any good.
Okay, go ahead.
We did a field test at my instance. And we put a flak jacket, an Army flak jacket, over a sandbag at 10 feet away.
Mm-hmm.
You could pour fire a 45 at it, and it would not penetrate that flak jacket.
Wow.
I could go up there with my buck hunting knife, and I could jab it through rather easily.
Mm-hmm.
I doubled the flak jacket and was almost able to penetrate both sides in one jab.
Wow.
But a 45 wouldn't do it. And that's when I said, well, that may have stopping power, but I want some firepower. Secondly, when you're on convoys, you don't want to be sitting on a convoy with a 45.
Mm-hmm.
You want something that would put out a lot of ammo. So all the officers, everybody carried rifles on convoys and all that.
M16s?
I mean, yeah, M16s.
Okay. All right, so when Tech kicked off, what was the reaction of the unit? Was the unit surprised, or were you just surprised as a new person there?
No, I think everyone was surprised.
Okay.
Because from the time the battalion had arrived, they had, even though they were supporting the Battle of Khe Sanh, they were shooting from other locations, Battle of Khantian.
Mm-hmm.
And this was the first time during this period when he started receiving direct shelling everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were pretty aggressive on their enemy artillery was. They'd really gotten a lot of artillery in there unknown to the U.S. They did a pretty good job. And they fired during cloudy weather.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't tell where they were coming from, really. And I know one of my jobs was doing crater analysis. We'd take take a couple of guys out. We'd measure the angles of the craters, and they did that from other locations, try to figure out where they were firing from. And I remember getting one command to get us a crater analysis back, and stuff still poured in. I said, yes, sir, but I told the guys, I said, let's let this slack up a little bit before we get out there and start measuring craters.
Mm-hmm.
And then we get to that, and they try to use it to compute angles. And then sometime about that time, they got some better radar detection equipment that supposedly helped locate those guns, because after 1968, the guns lined up across the DMZ were pretty well thinned out.
Hmm. You, on our side or theirs?
We thinned their guns out.
Okay. You had taken out a lot of their guns.
Yeah, we'd taken out a lot of their guns. But I don't think public ever knows they had long-range artillery. They had long-range artillery up there before the U.S. did. They were out distancing the U.S. initially.
Well, I was just going to say that. Didn't they have some of the Soviet-made or Chinese-made really
130 millimeter long-range artillery? It's a good piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a good, reliable, long-wear gun. And the U.S. only came in initially with 155 guns, which has about half the range.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why they brought in our guns to match the North Vietnamese long-range artillery.
That's why they brought the 175s in.
That's right.
Okay.
And so that being Marine territory, that's why they gave us to the 12th Marine Brigade, which is under the 3rd Marine Division. And then we also had batteries assigned to the 11th Marine Brigade, which is under the 1st Marine Division.
Okay.
Now, the 1st Marine's covered usually from Hue down to Da Nang, and the 3rd Marine's usually covered just across the DMZ.
Okay. But during the bulk of Tet, the first 4 months, you were a communications officer.
I think that was my official title.
What were you doing, though, in terms of your actual day-to-day activities?
day-to-day activities was I would be go to various batteries on special assignments, maybe carrying communications, crypto. Even one time, I had to do a turn at pay officer, but everybody got that. We assisted in fire direction, and basically as a fill-in officer. And a lot of the officers, newly arrived officers, would start out there, and then they'd filter them down to the batteries, firing batteries, as they got their feet on the ground well. So we seldom ever sent a just totally green officer out to be in charge of a fire direction center or a firing battery. You needed to have your feet on the ground. Mm-hmm. And we had a couple of them that never adapted or never had the confidence to even serve with the guns, and they just find someplace to put them.
Now, did you receive any kind of training by the unit during that four-month period?
In reality, the officers did not. We were pretty well, I'd say the officers, there wasn't much more you can train us in artillery. At least those that had paid attention to what they'd been doing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you'd have officers that their first assignment in the States was some staff job somewhere that really didn't get exposed to the field artillery like I did. And they were really behind from that standpoint. So if they were going into a firing battery, they would work under other lieutenants and all that until they really had a good grasp of it, because that was the type of job that you really had to take serious. You couldn't just, you just had so much at stake.
Mm-hmm.
And so the officers had to be, you really had to have confidence in them before you could turn them loose with the fire direction centers or the guns or whatever. And I don't know if I might mention here, from reading the history of the battalion and wearing out those 1,000 tubes, we never had a friendly fire casualty that was the result of a human error, ammunition error, or equipment error. And we did a lot of close support, recon teams and all that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a record I'm real proud of.
Yes, sir.
Not many. There's other 175 gun battalion that we had, a sister battalion, that had a terrible record. And it was also up there, 2nd 94th, if you want to quote. They had a lot of bad luck.
What do you attribute their higher rate of friendly fire casualties to? What?
Well, I think it starts at the top. I don't know, it just seemed like that our people were so concerned from the top on down that we didn't want to kill any of our own men. And I know the 2nd 94th also blew up one of their guns because their sergeant had a round that got stuck in the tube during a check fire, and he decided to fire it out with a bell rammer stuck at the end of it. He blew up the gun.
Oh, for crying.
And injured several Marines doing it. And we did have an NCO that sunk a couple of our APCs, which is stupid, but it's not something that affects so many people, if you know, and does not result in letters home to parents and stuff.
Right. How did he sink your APC?
Well, during a monsoon, he forgot to put the plug in it and sunk it.
Oh, for crying out loud.
And then he did it again. But he was not permitted to drive one after that.
Okay.
Those aluminum made armored personnel carriers, and we'd have one is also designed, just it's a little bit of adaptation for fire direction centers and all that, to be on a mobile track.
Mm-hmm.
And they're lighter aluminum; they'll literally float going through a swamp or something like mm-hmm. that. They don't afford very good protection for an RPG. No protection for an RPG. Some protection for a small arms fire, you know, rifles.
Yes, sir. You're talking about 113s.
What?
You're talking about the M113, correct?
Let me see. What was our? Well, M113 is the standard.
Mm-hmm.
Is the standard infantry one.
Right.
Now we have one. It's a M. I forgot the number of it. it's a higher, a little higher ceiling for the FTC.
Okay.
And I can't remember. I cannot remember. I've got a cell phone that's going off here, and I've got to let it finish going off.
Okay.
Anyway, it stopped now. Okay. Anyway, I forgot the number on it. I could get it.
But it's about the equivalent, correct?
Yeah, about the equivalent. Yes.
Let's see. And for that 4 months, the first 4 months, as Tet was unraveling and all that stuff was happening, did you move around quite a bit with your job?
Yeah, I was moving quite a bit during that one just because I was a utility officer subject to being sent wherever the colonel wanted at any point
right.
in time.
What did you observe of the morale of the various batteries and units you
yeah,
visited?
Okay. What I observed was our guys, of course, the incoming, constant incoming is pretty demoralizing.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember but our guys took it well. But I remember an NCO that just stayed relaxed all the time. He said, don't worry about it. If the round has your number on it, you're not going to avoid it. And if it doesn't have your round number on it, it'll never get you. Of course, he was not careless either, though.
Right.
But he had a real calm, relaxed attitude. Now, I've only seen one guy like that in my life, and he believed it. But I remember during that time, and we've got several stories on there where we had one of our guns, well, we had one gun blown off the road between, on the DMZ, and we had an ambush and all that. And I remember seeing those guys sometimes when they'd come in pretty bloodied up. But the Army morale was pretty good. But I thought during that time the Marine supply system was disgraceful. They did not take care of their men.
Mm.
And we were sharing what we had with them. We'd be begging beside the road up there across the DMZ because the Marine Corps was just not equipped to supply them. Of course, a little bit of that is Marine mentality. I love the guys, but they kind of pride themselves in being able to do without nothing. And but they were undersupplied at that time, and that really troubled me then. It still does that they would do that because it was inexcusable.
What things would you have to supply them with?
Well, they had trouble even getting food for a long time.
Oh, goodness.
And they'd have them undersupplied in food. Like they were so desperate to keep caissons supplied, the bases between caisson and the coast were totally neglected, and you'd have Marines out beside the road begging, and which I thought was disgraceful.
Yes, sir.
And later on, they did a better job, but at that point in time, they did a pretty bad job.
Mm-hmm. Well, were there ever any shortages in your unit for those first 4 months?
Well, I remember I didn't get any mail for 2 months
because
of the system was so screwed up.
Mm-hmm.
So all of our spouses for newly arrivals were a little bit into a quandary about what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
But we were able to get mail out
so
we could tell them what's going on, but we weren't getting mail in. You know, it's easy to collect it, ship it out. It's harder to get in and spread it out. Or apparently that's the way it was working.
Mm-hmm.
But they finally got, finally the chaos of the Tet pretty well cleared up. Then they started the Battle of Dong Ha, late April of 68.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a book written on that called The Battle of Dong Ha, the Army-Marine Joint Defense of Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where an NVA division got within a mile of Dong Ha, which was 3rd Marine main location, really. And they had a battle there for a whole division. It's probably the largest battle that's ever literally fought in Vietnam, and it's not all that widely publicized. But because of the terrain there, which is not as much vegetation, it ended up being a suicidal mission for the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
But there were Marine casualties taken in that battle, which I thought was somewhat needless. They could have moved their men back and let the artillery and aircraft take care of them for a while.
Mm-hmm.
But they had to jump in there, and when I personally didn't think it was necessary from what I've read since then. But some of them wanted to use some of those Marine colonels' words. They wanted to get bloodied a little bit, get some medals. And so, anyway, I thought that was a little bit inappropriately handled.
Mm-hmm. Now, this is in April after you've left your...
Well, it started at the end of April, and I really left the week after they had left.
Okay.
It started at the end of April. Well, let me see. Is it the end of March or end of April when that battle started? It was about the same time. And then when I went on down to what's called B Battery, which was out west of Da Nang toward the, what they call the Quezon Valley, but it's spelled different from the other Quezon. The other one was K-H-E.
Yeah, this is Q-U-E-S-O-N.
Yeah. Did you have that from other source or what?
Yeah, I'm just a little familiar with the geography and stuff.
Okay. Yeah, so this is the Quezon, Q-U-E-S-O-N.
Mm-hmm. So when you... Are there any other stories or other events that you remember from those first 4 months?
From the first what?
For the first 4 months in your staff position?
I told you about, there's a story in there about David Providence, which you probably hadn't read that one.
Which one is this now?
When the four guys were killed at Dong Ha, round at Kim Him.
Okay.
David Providence was one of our guys that was wounded and spent 2.5 years in hospital. And I always thought he was dead and saw him at a reunion in 2000. And he had one arm that's kind of useless. But I recognized him by his accent.
Okay.
He was from Mississippi. You can't forget somebody from Mississippi since he talked like one.
Mm-hmm.
And anyway, when I saw the guy, I remember I asked somebody, I said, who is that? And they told me about it. I said, what happened? They explained it. I said, well, he's supposed to be dead. Well, anyway, that's when I found out later that he had survived. And at the reunion, one of the former battalion commanders, a two-star general, used him as a topic for his banquet presentation. It was real moving. There's a story about him in there also.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, Providence, that was the day when I was there and the round came in, and I hit the dirt and thought it cleared us, and then hit right in the middle of a group. And then they dropped a few more in. One of them didn't die. He was evacuated for wounds. And he didn't die until that fall. And he's not on the wall, and we can't find out why he's not on the wall. But we're carrying him on our battalion, killed in action, because we know he was evacuated for wounds, died the same year.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. We can't find out. We can't find anybody has any information on him.
Well, that's a shame.
Yeah, I know. And we can't find his relatives or anything. We know his name, social security number, where he's from.
Just out of curiosity, has anybody made a FOIA request for his official records?
You know, I don't think they have. Okay. But, you know, we might could do that. We've got his social security number, and right. He was a first sergeant.
And we can talk about that after the interview.
Okay.
We might be able to help you get the...
I mean, he could have been killed in a car wreck later, but I doubt it.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so when you... Are there any other stories or anything you want to talk about with regard to your staff time?
Oh, let me see. No, it's just that I was in a situation where I could be in a lot of places and learn a lot of other people's what was going on in other areas. And I do remember, though, the radio traffic about Long Bay and all that, personally listening into that radio traffic, some of that. And the
Special Forces camp was overrun there?
Yes. Yes, well, that's one of them that the guns were firing for, because they were only long-range guns within proximity of it.
Right.
And at night, if you think about it, if you're shooting at night and they've got the grid coordinates, they can call fire in there and then walk it back to them.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't hardly tell a F-4 where to put a bomb at night. So.
No.
And it's terribly dangerous. We did have... An F-4 to bomb out our Charlie battery one night, and we could see it from Dong Ha. And I remember just blasting the hell out of it, and I said, oh, man, they're getting them. And nobody realized that they were bombing Charlie battery. It was the Navy, and they made two passes in there. And what did it happen? Actually, they wiped out a South Vietnamese artillery battery and damaged some of our equipment, but we didn't lose any men on that bombing, but... It was, but they had, there was a duster unit. You heard the term dusters yet?
Mm-hmm.
Twin 40s.
Mm-hmm.
They were getting ready to start shooting at them, since that was the original design of a duster, was that here. do remember watching B-52 arc lights. Do remember being at Carroll and watching them arc light the hill across from it. And then the enemy start shooting from it after the dust cleared. I don't see how anybody could live through it. And they were just shooting right afterward just to let us know, just to laugh at us, to show the thumb at us.
What did you think about that?
Oh, man, that's incredible guts. Incredible capacity to survive.
Mm-hmm.
It's absolutely incredible. The enemy was, I don't know if they operate out of fear or inspiration, but considering their logistics and all that, they did a fine job.
Yes, sir. Well, is that an attitude that you had going in, or did that evolve over time, a respect for the enemy?
More over time. You know, more then, they're trying to kill us. Let's kill them after.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I noticed there's some question there about guilt, about killing the enemy. All I never met anybody having guilt about killing the enemy when they're shooting at you all the time. I never knew of anybody having guilt about shooting back and killing them. I do remember one time watching a target somewhere, one of the Dong Ha or Carroll or one of those places, and we were watching a target in a no-fire zone, and they were calling fire on it, and I said, well, that's just a farmer. And he said, no, he's in VA. He says, we got to wipe him out. He's in no-fire zone. And they did call fire on him. Of course, when the fire comes in there, all you see is dust and smoke, so you can't tell, you know, at a long distance whether you got them or not. I remember having initial scruples about that, but then when the rockets and everything started coming out of that night, you know, you figure they were enemy.
So the rules of engagement for your unit were if they were in a free fire zone, they were fair game?
Generally speaking, that's true. Now, there are some situations, but this is up north, where there really weren't many civilians there.
Mm-hmm.
You get down around the Quezon Valley, and they had some real problems down there from my readings, sometimes when they were legitimate civilians in free fire zones.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, they used a little bit of good judgment on free fire zones.
Mm-hmm.
The Marines, I think, overall used pretty good judgment. Of course, a lot of them were just young kids, if you look back.
Mm-hmm.
Can you imagine the 18, 19-year-olds out there being in charge of major life or death decisions and
yes,
all
sir.
That.
Mm-hmm.
But generally speaking, now I remember back in the Quezon Valley at a place called Hill 65, we watched a whole unit come across in uniform in a free fire zone. Well, you know, that's obviously no problem whatsoever. Don't call it fire on those.
Okay. Well, during the first 4 months, did you have very much interaction with the Vietnamese people?
Yes, I did. We would see the thing that amazed me, the U.S. would hire them to do chores, fill sandbags. We were desperate trying to get sandbags. We'd hire civilians to help fill sandbags. And you'd have a little six-year-old kid that would be called the honcho. And he'd have his parents and grandparents out there working for him, and he'd be barking orders. And the reason was because the kid's the only one that can speak any English. You know how little kids can pick it up. So little children were always the honchos,
mm-hmm.
because they could pick up the language so quickly.
Yeah.
And that always fascinated me. I remember seeing one little kid that had his hand blown off or something. And I still remember that. Kind of a sad thing.
Mm-hmm.
But he seemed to have good spirits.
Mm-hmm.
When I say blown off, it's partially blown off.
Okay. While you're traveling again, did you not just Vietnamese civilians, what about Arvin units?
Yeah, we'd see some Arvin units. I remember the Arvins and the civilians back then. I thought, man, they really love Americans. They really love us.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, looking back in history, I think they were going to love whoever's there that's in power.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's survival. And, of course, they like their food and their money and gifts and all that. So
mm-hmm.
I thought, boy, they really love Americans. But probably loved whoever was the winner and whoever had the goodies.
Yeah. Okay. And And while you were traveling around these various units, did you ever witness any problems with the Army's logistics system, shortages of supplies for American Army units?
Not anything that I could say was inexcusable.
Okay.
There is one. They'd use a FADAC computer, artillery would, and they never could keep those computers. They usually had to always use slide rules because the computers took a 240-volt generator. Mm-hmm. Never could keep a generator that operate.
Okay.
And so they never had those, so went back to the dark age most of the time.
Well, what was it like transitioning from a staff position to, I would imagine, a battery commander position?
Well, no, it'd be firing battery.
A firing battery.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I remember the battalion commander said, "You ready to go?" And I was so excited.
Mm-hmm.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And because that's where the action is.
Yes, sir.
That's where you use your talents, and you're with the troops, and. It's a different life. I know what part there'd be times, though, when I might be out with enlisted men, be the only officer there for a month, and because of the, you know, the socialization policy is a little lonesome at those times. But
Now
we're good friends. We don't have to worry about that since we've located some men.
Mm-hmm. Well, what was it? Why don't you go ahead and describe where it was that you were assigned, which battery, which firing battery?
Okay, I went into B battery, which was further south,
mm-hmm.
and it was under operational control of the 1st of the 11th Marine Group Brigade. And by the way, let me interrupt a second. I'm on a battery unit phone here,
okay.
And if we should lose contact, I'll call back on another phone. I better get a phone number from you.
Or if you want, you can give me your phone number, and I'll just call you back
okay.
on the new number.
All right. Call me back on 670.
Mm-hmm.
3342.
670-3342.
Right.
Okay. Good enough.
All right.
Thank you, sir.
Anyway, let me see. We're talking about the firing battery.
Yes, sir.
You still there? Hello?
Yes, sir. Yes,
okay.
sir.
Okay. Your question was, your specific question was?
Oh, just to describe which unit you were assigned to.
Okay. And it was B battery, and B battery basically was covering the what they call the rocket belt that came out of that Quezon Valley, spelled Q-U-E.
Mm-hmm.
And the Songview River runs through that valley. And there were some heavy marine battles in there from 66 through 69, actually. And so we did a lot of recon firing. They came up with what's called force recon, marine force recon. And we would fire a lot of recon teams. They mm-hmm. stick them way the heck out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a story about a Marine recon unit that was at their maximum range and was in a position of being overrun. And I don't know if you read that particular one.
Yes, saving a recon patrol?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
And that was typical of the operation, except the first instance we'd heard where they got dangerously out of range.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I never did know whether they got lost or misplaced or what happened. Because they would never knowingly stick them beyond air support or something.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, that was an exciting time. And when the commands would come in, you'd always keep the gunners informed, because there's something about the spirit of a gunner. If they know they're shooting for a purpose, they really get fired up and inspired. And, mm-hmm. and they will... You can have incoming artillery or whatever, and they will risk their lives to accomplish their mission. I mean, it's unbelievable when they know they're really shooting a live fire mission.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the firing was just shooting at suspected targets.
Okay.
More so up north than where we were. A lot of our firing was observed targets and the recon teams.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say observed targets, that's where you have an actual observer calling the rounds. Adjustments and actually seeing the targets.
Mm-hmm. And calling in appropriate adjustments to bring
right.
fire for effect.
Right, uh-huh.
Well, for that one incident where you fired for that recon team that was out of range,
mm-hmm.
Describe the interaction that occurred there. What this was a Marine recon unit.
Right, and, you know, just a bunch of kids, the way it hit me at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And when they called in, they were all, you know, of course, my mind, these guys are about to cry. They're so scared. And we try to calm them down and said, well, you know, you're on the range, but we'll give it a try. But here's what you risk. You risk us putting it on top of you. And which I guess we got them closer than we ever knew. You saw the after note on that.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they didn't reply back, I thought, well, you know, we lost them. Mm-hmm. They were out of range. And then it was just exhilarating when they finally reported back. And then when our battery commander then went into the 11th Marine Brigade, and that's when he learned the rest of the story, but he never told us until recently.
Mm-hmm. But you got some good feedback.
Yeah.
I guess after the fact, 33 years after the fact, mm-hmm. But even at the time, you finally did make radio contact. And
yeah, we made radio contact before, about 15 to 30 minutes later, but it seemed like it's eternity.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what they did is the enemy thought we had their number, and because the 175 sound of a round, one of those things hitting, it had the same 10, a different composition from an 8-inch, but the same explosive firepower.
Okay.
And the sound of it is like a lot more than just a 105.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm sure that when they heard that one round hit, the fear of their lives, they did not want any more of that at all.
Right. How heavy is one of those rounds?
A 75 is 147 pounds. An 8-inch was 204 pounds. Mm-hmm. But an 8-inch would only shoot half as far.
Mm.
So now they talk about comparative accuracy, that the 8-inch was more accurate, but if an 8-inch was shooting as far as we were, they probably wouldn't be as accurate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because the further you're shooting, even if you're shooting with a rifle, the further out you are, the less accurate you are.
Right.
And so, but I thought for our long-range shooting, when we're shooting within 50 meters of live troops, which we did from time to time,
mm-hmm.
and you had to know what you were doing to do that.
Uh-huh.
And I remember several times I'd have a Marine corporal call fire and then find out he's on the gun target line. And you could tell he was inexperienced. And I'd tell our guys, I said, you just add a quarter of a mile to what he called on them. And he'd say, oh, perfect, right where I wanted it. I had to land it behind him.
Oh, for crying out loud.
That happened several times.
Oh, wow.
We took care of our guys, and they didn't even know it.
Wow.
But if you're on the gun target line, though, you'd see that it's more danger than if you're looking at it from the side.
Yes, sir.
And so if they were on the gun target line, you really had to look out for them.
Right.
And that was sort of an officer's discretion thing, and mm-hmm. we would do it that way. And then generally, the way we operated where we were, you would have one lieutenant that'd be on duty, and he'd be in charge of both the guns and the fire direction. But we had good NCOs in charge of the firing guns, so it's really helped a lot.
What was the blast radius of one of those rounds?
Well, it said it had a killing radius
mm-hmm.
of up to 300 meters. That's like a quarter of a mile.
Wow.
But that's not an effective killing radius.
Especially in jungle with a lot of foliage.
Yeah. Or even in the open. It doesn't mean anybody in that circle is going to get killed. It means you're only going, some of them may get killed.
Right.
The effective radius, though, I think if you're within 100 meters in open blast, chances are that, I believe they said more than half are going to be killed if you're within 100 meters in open.
Wow. That's a good distance.
Yeah, and a pretty good percentage. Now, if you're within 25 meters, you're dead.
Now, are these, are the rounds set to burst before they hit the ground? Are they air burst? Or?
We had air burst. There's something you probably never heard before, but our A battery dropped airburst over Quezon.
Okay.
When they were afraid that they were being
mm-hmm.
coming in, they got all the guys on the ground and dropped a couple of airbursts in there. But most of ours was impact.
Okay.
And especially if you're shooting vegetation, you know, your airburst may not be too effective.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have that one story in there where we did a fire mission using direct fire. And with a 175 direct fire, doesn't mean they're on you. It can be a mile away.
Mm-hmm.
And we put it on delay fuses so they'd bounce. It'd go underground about 2 or 3 feet. They'd bounce back up in the air maybe 60 feet, and you get air burst.
Wow.
And so we have one mission where we did that. I still have the old firing data chart that shows how many fired, estimated, killed, and how many rounds shot and all that.
And this was your direct fire mission?
Mm-hmm. I still have the fire mission chart for that.
Right.
But since it's not official, that's the only official record I have. It was their own firing chart, and I took a photograph of it just to have a record of it.
Now you would, these were enemy out there in the open.
Yes.
And how effective was the fire against them?
We can only guess, but I would guess that probably half of them were casualties.
Wow.
Because, you know, once that first round hits, they're scattering.
Yes.
But to this day, we'll never know why they were out in the open. It right. was either rookie troops or they were lost or something.
And these were standard HE rounds you were using?
Yes.
Okay.
But put them on a delay fuse
mm-hmm.
so that it hits and it delays a tenth of a second before it bursts. But in that tenth of a second, the round can go in, bury, and come back up in the air and gives you an air burst.
Wow.
We learned that at Fort Sill, but I never dreamed that we'd get to use it in reality.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you say you learned it by accident in training, or it was taught
no,
to you?
It was taught at okay. Fort Sill that you could get an air burst out of a delay fuse.
Interesting.
And so I never dreamed. Who dreamed you'd think about jungles in Vietnam? Who ever dreamed that
right.
you'd been shooting? But it was down in the valley that you could get an air burst, get mm-hmm. to have an opportunity to shoot the air burst, mm-hmm. bouncing air burst.
Yeah. But for the normal air burst rounds, those had proximity fuses?
Most of them we used were... impact fuses.
Right, but for the ones that you did use for long range
for air burst, were variable time.
Oh, okay.
They, it's proximity, same thing.
Okay. Yeah.
And recon people would use those sometimes to locate themselves.
Really?
Yeah, they'd call a round on a place on the map they thought it should hit,
mm-hmm.
and then they could get a pretty good idea
right.
if they're where they're supposed to be.
Right. Because you could then tell them the actual coordinates where you thought that round should hit yourselves,
right. mm-hmm.
and you could gauge from that. Oh,
right.
Okay. That's interesting.
And so there was a lot of that locator rounds, what we called them.
I think that could be kind of dangerous for a recon unit to do, though. They must be
if they were on the gun target light, we watched out for them.
Right.
We hoped that they weren't on the. Generally, we hoped they weren't on the gun target light. Yeah.
Yeah,
and a lot of them were impact mm-hmm. on the locator rounds if they could see where they thought it was supposed to land.
Right, right.
And even if they couldn't see, they could hear it.
Right. But it would be also dangerous from the standpoint of giving away the fact that they're there.
Well, not necessarily, because we fired a lot of this suspected target.
Okay. So it could just be one of those free fire zone
rounds. H&Is, as they called it.
Yeah, harassing and
interdiction. Right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A lot of the, when I said suspected targets, a lot of that's really H&Is.
Okay.
And there's a lot of ammunition wasted on H&Is.
Now, did you feel that at the time, or did you feel that in retrospect?
Did I feel what?
That it was wasted.
No, I didn't feel it was wasted because we knew that if we didn't get a target, it had to be terribly demoralizing.
Right. Unless there was absolutely nobody there to witness it.
Yeah. But you pretty well knew there was going to be somebody within a mile of it.
Yeah.
And if you're in a half a mile of it, it is distressing.
Okay.
In fact, B-52s, when they dropped, they never wanted to drop closer than a mile. And I did see some dropped within a half a mile.
Mm-hmm.
But that's getting to be the danger zone.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I mean, real dangerous to get closer than a half a mile.
Mm-hmm.
But they call those arc lights, and I saw a lot of arc lights. It's impressive. I'm impressed with the Air Force.
Mm-hmm. Well, did you have any other kind of rounds besides the air burst and the high explosive?
We did not have the white phosphorus rounds like the smaller guns did.
Okay.
Or smoke.
Mm-hmm. Well, and they did eventually develop the beehive rounds for the smaller guns too, didn't they?
Yeah, the smaller guns had beehive rounds and
even canister.
Canister, yeah.
Canister
they have rounds, and I've read of instances of them being used
mm-hmm.
During the siege and first of Tet up there. Our guns were considering what to do in those circumstances, and
mm-hmm.
there's a couple of experiments of firing the guns without a round, just the powder charge,
because
you are your enemy if they didn't blow you up first.
Okay.
But I don't know of any instances where that was ever used mm-hmm. in other than a rehearsal situation.
I see.
With a 175.
Mm-hmm. Now, what was your first experience as a firing battery commander dealing with...
Okay, it'd be platoons. We fired by platoons, really. Yeah.
As a platoon commander.
Yeah, platoon commander. That would be just all kinds of general firing, everything from the recon to the... Well, one of the first ones, though, was that... one of the first ones after I got there was that direct fire mission.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not direct... When people think of direct fire, you think of you being overrun or something, but it was not that situation that we were looking at. But because of our range, it was direct fire to us. Because you set the guns almost on level, and the guns were actually on a hill, so it was direct fire. But it was not close-range direct fire.
Right.
And so that was one of the first deals we had. And by the way, the co-author of that story is a lieutenant, the only guy I kept up with in Vietnam. And he was married also when he was at Fort Sill.
Okay.
He was in Tommy Frank's OCS class. Hmm. Also, his first 6 months were spent with Tommy Frank's battery in Vietnam, or they were in the same battery.
Mm-hmm.
Then he transferred to our unit and I stayed in touch with Wade is his name. He became an FBI agent and has since retired.
Mm-hmm.
Fine guy, a little unusual. They homeschooled their five children.
Hmm.
Of course, all of them are real achievers.
Mm-hmm.
My wife's a teacher. She doesn't believe in homeschooling, but admits that there are some exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
Some you know, if you got educated, inspired parents, it'll work. Otherwise, that's just a sad thought, though.
Right.
But anyway, Wade was the other guy on that, and he was the only lieutenant that I really kept in touch with. He was the only guy I kept in touch with past Vietnam.
Okay. And that's Alec Wade.
Yeah. Uh huh.
Okay. When you were platoon commander, what was the morale of your platoon like? How many men were under your charge? How many guns did you have?
For 175s, there's only two guns. It takes a lot of men to man one of those things.
Mm-hmm.
If you imagine lifting several tons of ammunition throughout the night,
plus
they have to guard their own perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that there'd be times that we'd have to check them for guard positions at night. And there'd be times that we're so busy to catch a guy at sleep and, you know, you've got to act like he's ruined everybody and he's ruined himself and he's going to kill us all and all that. But there wasn't a lot you could do if he did the best he could.
Mm-hmm.
And so different guys use different deals. I know one guy woke him up with a .45 to his head and said, next time I catch you, you're going to be dead and all that. Of course, he wouldn't shoot his old guy, but some of those young men you could scare enough to, they find a way to stay away.
Mm-hmm.
I really felt sorry for some of the times because they had to work so hard and fire all the time and then also man the perimeter and all that. For an enlisted man in a firing unit that fired a lot of artillery, heavy artillery, it was a hard job.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they worked around the clock. There wasn't much free time. That's one thing about it, though. When you're working that hard, there's no time for mischief, no time for racial spats and all that.
What was the cycle that you went through in terms of being out in the field and getting some rest time?
Well, it run in cycles. I remember one time, one of the most pleasant times was in the fall of 68. They had a monsoon.
Mm-hmm.
And we were isolated. We couldn't be supplied. And there was no enemy activity. And all we did is sit and read books for 3 weeks while the rain poured. But it was a real fun time.
Hmm.
And so there'd be times you'd have idle time just to do nothing.
Mm-hmm. And exactly what was the location, again, of your unit?
Okay. It would be on the western side of the battery unit.
Mm-hmm.
Battery headquarters would be on the western side of Da Nang.
And where was
it? It was called Hill 34 is the headquarters. We would have a platoon there about half the time, and then we'd have one platoon going to 6-5, maybe a platoon going to a place called Anwa.
Mm-hmm.
And not when I was there, but before I got there, they had one at 5-5 at times. And they'd rotate them in and out at various different places. The Marines would start an operation, say we need a platoon of guns this place at one time or a platoon here, so forth.
Okay. So basically you would just move around to provide cover for the
right.
Marines.
For if they start an operation, they want some guns there, then we'd move a platoon in to cover them.
And you moved your guns with the equivalent of the M113 tracked vehicle.
Well, now, the guns themselves are self-propelled.
Oh, these are self-propelled 175s.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
They go about 50 miles an hour.
Okay. You can't fire on the go, though.
No, I could not fire those on the go. I am told the Crusader that was trashed could fire on the go.
Yeah.
But no, it could not fire on the go. But we could get them in and get dug in and be firing within, you know, just a few minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But that's what I was talking about. Like we had in early 68, we lost one gun. It was blown off the road by a mine. Mm-hmm. And then throughout the time the battery was in Vietnam, they lost all their guns, the equivalent of all their guns at one time or other, from direct hits or mines.
Mm-hmm.
But that, for a battalion, that's only 12 guns, see?
Right.
Because it takes so many men to man them.
Yeah.
But when they were on the road, they moved.
And I'm sorry, how many men did you have again?
Okay, each gun would have, I'm thinking around 15 men or so, something like that.
Okay, so about 30-man platoon.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Pretty close to an infantry platoon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
What is 30 or 40 men, something like that.
Yep.
And so during that time, you'd have some that are sleeping. And you had to have that because some of them had to sleep while the others are shooting. And that was one thing the Army owned a lot of things, and like on the fire direction centers,
mm-hmm.
they'd have so many enlisted men, but they overlooked the fact that these guys, if they were heavy shooting all the time, worked around the clock, so they didn't assign enough. They just assigned it as if you went out on a day and had a mission and went home at night.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had to train surveyors and other some of the more intelligent enlisted guys, we'd have to cross-train them. In fire direction, they might be. We'd have surveyors, some cannoneers that were particularly brilliant. We'd train them in the other areas.
Okay.
And remember, we had one of them, a brilliant CO that could do anything, and knew all the small arms, knew everything, and he was the guy that I don't have a story in that because he was court-martialed and it's a little sensitive deal for. Getting drunk and drawing a pistol on the CO.
This was a soldier that did this?
What?
This is one of the soldiers, one of your soldiers that did that?
One of our sergeants.
One of your sergeants pulled a gun on your CO?
Yes.
Oh, boy.
Stateside, he'd be locked away forever. They court-martialed him, and they called me to testify as court-martial, and he pled guilty.
Mm-hmm.
They just wanted somebody to kind of say something good about him, so I went up there and explained that all the good things he could do, and he was the one that manned the 50 caliber weapon in one of those stories I have.
Mm-hmm.
He was the one that manned that 50 caliber.
Mm-hmm.
And probably that saved him from being ruined. He lost 2 stripes and some pay
mm-hmm.
and earned his stripes back in a couple of months.
Wow.
That would have never happened stateside.
Mm-hmm. What was the reason for him drawing his weapon on the CO?
He was drunk.
He was just drunk.
Yes.
Was that the recreation of choice for the men?
Generally, you had a choice of a hot beer or a hot Coke. I chose hot Coke.
Okay.
Can't stand hot beer.
Yeah.
Not many people can.
No. But what would you? What would your unit? What would the men in your platoon do for recreation?
Oh, let me see. They read books. Later on, I read where they set up a basketball. I don't know. We didn't have it then, but they'd read books, play cards, write letters, tell stories. Just, probably not much different than if you went on a camping trip with a bunch of young guys.
Mm-hmm. But there were no other facilities available to you?
Not at the hillsides. Now, if they got closer to Da Nang, then they get turns getting to go in to maybe go to... if you went into Da Nang, there's a big PX there.
Mm-hmm.
And so they'd get a turn to go into one of them.
Okay.
There's a story that our CO tells. It's not on there, but remember Charles Robb, who was a Marine, he's Lyndon Johnson's son-in-law?
Mm-hmm.
And our CO tells this story that when we were at Six make a deal with Rob, said if you'd give us a few men to help escort when we're running ammunition trucks out. Says we'll then take your guys in periodically when we go supply runs and then go back to Denang and go to PX or whatever. You know, you filter so many back every now and then and give them a break. And Rob, who's there in his hooch, which is all director, all uncharacteristic of the typical Marine, overly decorated and with a couple of bottles of whiskey. I'm not saying he's drunk or anything, but he was had a lot more than his men did, and he looked at my CO and said, they don't need it, they're Marines. And so my CO says, fuck you, and walked off. So from this day, he doesn't like Charles Robb, because he said he didn't think he cared for his men.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of stories that aren't on the web for,
right,
for
right.
a purpose.
Oh, yeah.
Like the story about the guy that was killed the next day. We didn't put that on there just because his parents might learn about it or something.
Yeah.
But it is a story that will probably make its way into a book.
Mm-hmm.
And we are writing a battalion book, which I'll get into post deal with you later when you get to that stage of it.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, while you were out there with your platoon, was your line ever probed? Was your perimeter ever probed? Did you guys do active patrolling to make sure that didn't happen? You know, how did you prevent yourselves from getting hit by the enemy?
Okay, well, let's go back to Dong Hai, for example. They would patrol those areas at night, and they would get a number of men from various maybe infantry units or artillery units or whatever and sign them. I do remember I was assigning a NCO, he was a black NCO, to be on this patrol, and he balked and refused. He made a big scene, which it could have been handled easier if he had made a big scene in front of a bunch of people. But he was short. You heard the term short?
Yes, sir.
Okay. So anyway, he finally talked me out of it. I just regret that he didn't contact me privately instead of making this scene in front of everybody. Could have been handled a lot easier. But anyway, so he got off of that one, but we'd have to sometimes assign men for patrol. So here you have artillery men who man the guns in or occasionally also decide to go to patrol. But really there was not much of that. The infantry guys, usually any patrols were handled strictly by infantry. We had fixed, you know, just perimeter, what we call perimeter positions. And as far as a probe, as far as when I was at B Battery never had a probe as such, except, you know, firing from a distance. We have that deal where they're floating up the river that we don't know why they came in on that one. You know, the shooting NVA in the
mm-hmm.
borough.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know why they did that or why they got there. If they had tried to make a run at that location, they would have never gotten anywhere on that mm-hmm. one.
If you would describe what happened there with the NVA shooting the fish in the barrel.
Well, is it night and just a ferocious firefight broke out right in front of us. I mean, it was 200 or 300 meters out. And we couldn't figure out what to do. You mean it's cross-firing. And, you know, do you fire? Is there friendlies out there? Maybe we hit the wrong people or whatever. So we called in the 1st Marine Division and said, do you have any patrols out? Because we were getting ready to join in this thing. They said, no patrols. So we immediately told our guys, cut loose with everything you have. Of course, the guns couldn't get angled down to fire on it, so they just used the M79s and the 50 caliber and the 16s, and so they all joined in on it. It was not... So apparently, we don't know why they would have been coming down right in front of us under those circumstances. One possibility is they might have been planning to plant a couple of RPGs into our gun position up there. And that somebody detected them before they got there. But it's the strangest, bizarre thing I ever heard in my life. Who would ever thought you'd be shooting at boats with an artillery battery?
And in fact, you mentioned the story that this was this NVA unit came in contact with an Arvin outpost there.
Yeah, it was an Arvin platoon doing something there, but nobody ever told us that.
And it might be that you guys hit that that NVA unit, then they may have been planning an assault on your positions.
I think they were probably more after us than any Arvin group there. Mm-hmm. And because they were equipped to do it if they could have knocked a gun out.
Right.
And if the Arvins hadn't tipped them off, it could have happened.
Well, what was your food situation like? What did you guys eat?
You're not going to believe this, but I don't ever remember being hungry, but for the life of me, and I've talked to other guys that have had this experience, they cannot remember eating in a mess hall. But I know I ate in a lot of Marine mess halls.
Okay.
And Dong Ha had its own mess hall, and I can't even remember eating in there, but I know I did. When I was at B Battery, I know we ate with the Marines in their mess hall a lot, especially closer to Nang when we were on the hill.
Mm-hmm.
We would be supplied. And usually it was hot food.
Okay.
Now, like in the monsoon and the earthwormer cut off, we'd eat sea rations.
Mm-hmm.
And the sea rations were okay, except back then somebody conned the Army into buying what's called date pudding. And if you haven't heard that before, write it down and let me know the first time you talk to somebody that remembers date pudding.
Okay.
It's going to probably be pre-1969 is all I can figure out. And it must have been left over from Korea or something. Awful. And so, anyway, you couldn't give it away or anything. And so, but if you got pound cake or peaches or cookies, that was wonderful. The sea rations were good.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd usually cook with C4 explosives. Because I never saw a heat tablet when I was in the country. I don't know why they couldn't get heat tablets. That's pretty cheap compared to using C4 to cook with.
Mm-hmm.
But so we just got into, we had enough of our own C4, or you could always get it. So guys usually cooked with it.
Okay. Now, when you move from place to place, who would provide your support? Would it continue to be the Marine Corps, or would a battalion arrange for support, you know, food resupply, things like that, ammunition resupply and all that?
We had our own, starting at the origin, of course, it come in on ship ammunition, and it'd probably come into that naval depot, probably either the Nang or through the Quaviet at the mouth of the DMZ. It was more dangerous to bring it in at the Quaviet because that was real bad country up in there.
Mm-hmm.
But then it'd be loaded onto. Usually our own trucks would be sent down there to get it.
Okay.
And so from the ammunition supply, we did our own ammunition.
Mm-hmm.
And food supply. Basically, we were Army, we were Marines, because we were operational control to them, but we were supplied by the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot different, I'll tell you. Mm-hmm. That was one time, kind of a nice world to be in. I liked the Marines' spirit at that point in time, and I liked their attitudes, and we were supplied better.
And one of the other firing incidents you wrote about that was on the website was involved an aircraft, friendly fire issue.
Yes, the one that dropped in when nothing's going on?
Yeah.
I don't know. That's the most bizarre thing I ever saw in my life.
What happened there?
Just in the middle of broad daylight, one of those times when nothing has been going on.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing going on.
Mm-hmm.
And a plane comes in there and unloads on that village. Just, well, we thought it was going to fall on us because you could see the bombs falling.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once a jet passes, the sail's already gone. He's probably already passed you.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd see what's falling behind him when you look up. You don't see the plane, but you see these objects falling towards you. You know something bad's going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And this was a populated Vietnamese village that was hit?
It was a friendly village that the Marines had their medics and all that. They were really baby in that village. An airplane came in and just wiped them out. We don't know why.
And it was never determined what unit was responsible?
Oh, it might have been, but they wouldn't have told us out there.
Yeah.
Nobody ever found out.
How long did you stay in that area after that incident occurred?
I think I was at that location for a couple of months before I came home. I mean, it was a couple of months before I came home. I was there until I came home.
And that, you were there for a few weeks afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
What was the attitude of the village like after that?
Well, we had medics to go down there and check on it, but generally, I just felt sorry for these guys that had been babying them, and
yeah.
then suddenly it's kind of blasted away.
Right.
I did not go down and tour that village after that.
Okay.
We sent some guys down there that did, but.
Do you know if their attitude towards the Americans in the area changed?
Well, you know, here you are giving them medical attention even afterward.
Right.
And I'm sure they were happy to get the medical attention.
But, yeah, but man.
But how could it not have created a negative deal?
Yeah.
The thing to me was inexcusable. I can see it, like the bombing of the guns at night. I can see that happening.
Yeah, accidents happen.
And I can see friendly troops getting hit. And I just finished reading a book. They had a movie on it, We Were Soldiers.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And they had some friendly aircraft fire. But I could see that happening when they just can't tell what's what and they've got to do something. And even the deal at night, but in broad daylight when nothing's going on and everything's so visible, I just can't picture that happening. I mean, there was certainly nobody out there dropping smoke as a marker. There was no forward air controllers in the air or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
Or on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes forward air controllers were on the ground.
Right.
Mm. So that one's a mystery to me.
Were there any other serious friendly fire incidents involving aircraft that you knew of while you were there?
Let me see. I remember the one that I saw when they bombed the battery, the one where they bombed the village. I remember a 105 battery dropped one over our battalion at Dong Ha, but didn't hit anything. And we did it. I heard that somebody laid their guns in backwards. It would be easy to do with a towed unit because you orient on the north-south line.
Right, right.
And if you don't use a compass and you're initially facing the wrong direction, you could lay 180 degrees out. I could see that happen if you have a guy that doesn't know what a compass is.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure some officer really got his tail in the crack over that.
Yeah.
But it didn't hurt anybody. It didn't hit anything. It's, you know, scary, but it didn't hit anything. I remember, and that's the only ones I personally saw.
And I guess your unit never, you guys never got hit with, you did get hit with artillery, with enemy artillery.
And rockets.
Rockets. Okay.
140 millimeter rockets,
mm-hmm.
and 122 rockets. 122 is becoming fashionable when I got there.
Okay. What was that like?
Oh, gosh, that's like a jet plane coming in. Mm-hmm. Those things are loud. Mm-hmm. They're really a fear factor. And I can see why the Brits didn't like those rockets in World War II because they had a lot more in them.
Mm-hmm.
But these things were loud. The thing about it, they were so inaccurate that they could fire 20 of them at you and they usually didn't hit anything.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the artillery, I saw them walk those around us. And they could usually get something. You know, they'd start at one location, they'd just walk them to you. So I've seen that. So considering that they were shooting at pretty extreme range for their gun, mm-hmm. the 130, I thought they were probably pretty good gunners because at that range, they usually got something somewhere. I saw the ammunition dump hit personally twice, and that's a great fireworks.
Mm-hmm.
I never knew why the Marines kept their ammunition dump up there, why they didn't move it back a few miles. But I saw them blow it up twice. And I think what I read, they blew it up once before I got there, twice while I was there, and another two or three times after I left. And we're talking about millions of dollars of ammunition being blown up.
Mm-hmm.
It's one big fireworks story.
Yes, sir.
But they were pretty good. They seemed to be able to hit something pretty frequently, but then they had a lot of them they never hit anything to. And then I have a picture of my three-quarter ton truck that I used that was sprayed. Maiden hit. I've got a picture of that on my pictures on the side. And a picture of one of our tents that was direct hit.
Now, did you guys have any battery-on-battery engagements?
Yeah, well, yes, but that was when we weren't sure whether we were shooting at the right location.
Okay. I mean, nothing where you...
We didn't know where they were firing from.
Yeah, okay.
And I'll no doubt they knew exactly where we were firing from. Because, mm-hmm. you know, when you're assaulting force like that, you're kind of exposing yourself. You're out in... We come in there and, your location is well known.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that the way they hid their guns and all that, they did an excellent job. When they were firing for Quezon, the NVA was also firing from the west from a place called Coal Rock.
Okay.
K-O-R-O-C, if you come across that term yet.
Mm-hmm.
They were using their long-range guns, and it was not on the battery that was shooting at them, but it was another one of those. The XO that was in charge of that, I've talked to him, and he said that they were able to hit Coal Rock on a couple of occasions because the wind was blowing right.
Mm-hmm.
It was one of those shooting beyond maximum range, but on those long-range guns, if the wind is blowing right, you can get a couple of extra miles out of them.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's blowing wrong, it'll shorten your range a couple of miles.
Mm-hmm. So how would you get information about that, especially... given the terrain of Vietnam, in the area in which you're working, is hills and mountains, in some areas, how would you know how could you calculate the effect that the wind and other meteorological?
Oh, okay, yeah. Well, we'd have a map section.
Okay. Would you describe that, please, and how that worked?
Yeah. Our battalion was the map section for the whole I Corps for a while. Up there, I mean, from north of Da Nang. And they'd have a map section and send up balloons and get weather factors. There was four things you'd plug in to take into consideration for the map. I can't remember all of it. And so we would adjust our data basically sometimes hourly. So that's why we're able to be accurate regardless of weather changes.
Okay. Now, let's see. Did you ever provide support for any other units besides the Marines? Other American.
Well, okay. Of course, when the battalion was firing for Long Vay in that area, we would have had some Army in there. Remember, you had the special forces that were in that area. And then in 68, they went to the Ashall Valley, which I went down there for just a couple of days in the Ashall. And we were supporting... 1st Cav and parts of the 101st Airborne were in there also. Their base was at Camp Eagle at near Fubai. And the 1st Cav, they were everywhere all over the whole darn country. I'm going to say this. My impression of the 1st Cav was it was a hotshot unit. And I don't know if you've gotten a hold of any 1st Cav men yet, but they were a hotshot unit. But we had one battery firing on Operation Delaware. I don't know if you come across Operation Delaware. That was a spring, early 1968 Operation Delaware. We had a battery on Operation Delaware later in early 69, late 68, early 69. We had a battery on Operation Taylor. And a lot of times they never told us. We wouldn't have known the operation then. They just said, you're going there. The only way we found out what operation it was is reading history and going back in the books and operational reports. And by the way, our operational reports are on the web.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And that's one thing. When we started getting our history, the guys were so erroneous in dates, and I thought a lot of them times they might be making stuff up, but everything that we've got has been pretty well corroborated.
Okay.
By looking at the operational reports and other guys' stuff. Mm-hmm. We've had a couple of stories. One of them came across as one guy reported a story of blowing the direct fire, just using powder charge only.
Mm-hmm.
And I came back to him. I said, you're lying to him. He said, it's a good story, but you need to tell me the truth because that didn't happen. So well, maybe I'll think it's something I read.
Okay.
And I don't know if you get people manufacturing, fabricating stuff, but
No, well, not that we know of. No. Nothing serious.
Generally, you can tell sometimes they're fabricating stuff, and particularly if you've got people, other people in the area, you kind of corroborate what was going on. And also, when you've got this many guys we've now found, mm-hmm. not too many of them are inclined to lie because their brother will be caught.
That's right. That's right. Someone will dime them up. Well, did you, how about other foreign nationals, whether it be Koreans? Did you ever provide fire support knowingly for Arvin units that were out in the field? Some of the Thai units that were operating?
Well, we would have supported Arvins from time to time, but I just don't know the operation. And just like, I do know that the battalion after I was gone mm-hmm. was involved and was the most farthest unit west of Khe Sanh ever, was, and they had guns parked right on the border near the Laos border up there, mm-hmm. supporting the Arvins in their, what they call Lamson 719, which was the last big blast over there. And the Arvins kind of got their butts kicked, although we did get a lot of equipment. Material destroyed in that mission. But that was after I was gone, but I do know that there's stories and instances on the web where we supported that operation. And that was mainly, that was, by that time, it was strictly an Arvin operation.
Mm-hmm. Now, the missions that you supported when you were a fire battery platoon commander, did you know the types of units you were going up against? Was it always NVA, or was it sometimes VC?
No, I never, to my knowledge, we never, unless they happened to just be there, ours were always NVA enemy. Okay. And uniformed NVA enemy. Mm-hmm. Generally in the north that was the case. Mm-hmm. And only VC, we did have one gun blown off the road by a mine, and the reports that came back was it was command detonated, and they think that probably was VC, but as far as ever seeing any VC or having any engagements against VC, I don't know. We don't know of anything significant in that regard. But I do believe somewhere in the Khe Sanh Valley, well, they had both, though. Mm-hmm. They had VC, but the NVA were coming in there heavy by 68. Okay. Because that was one of their favorite routes in.
And you were never mortared? Only rocketed.
They got mortars when they first got there, mm-hmm. but not while I was there. When I was there, it was only artillery and rockets.
Okay.
And later on, they did get a lot of mortars. Mm-hmm. The battalion did, but still mainly just rockets.
Mm-hmm.
But it's mainly rockets and artillery.
Okay. One of the question I forgot to ask earlier when I was we were talking about the food situation. What were the overall living conditions like? Did you guys have hooches, tents? Where and how did you sleep?
Yeah, okay. We'd come in. They'd originally set up a tent, and then they'd build a wooden floor for it, and then you'd send back the walls, and that was basically the permanent living ranges. Mm-hmm. As they got time, especially those in the more exposed areas, then they would start building bunkers.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have them when I got there for the bunkers. They'd have one key bunker where, you know, if you're having income tax, you'd go get in the key bunker. Mm-hmm. And our battalion commander later took them out and made them make small bunkers. He didn't want that many men in one large bunker.
Yeah.
Later on, though, they started building individual gun section bunkers.
Okay.
They'd have an ammunition bunker, and they'd have a living quarters bunker, and they lived in the bunkers all the time. Now, this is the gunners.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's basically, most of that happened after I left. But I've got tons of photographs where they started building bunkers for the guns. And they literally lived in their bunkers all the time. When they weren't shooting, they stayed in their bunkers.
Hmm.
And they were a little slow getting bunkers built.
Mm-hmm.
And Khe Sanh, you know, Khe Sanh,
mm-hmm.
you know, if they'd have been smart, they'd have been building better protected bunkers when they went in there. But I don't think the Marines planned ahead very well on that, because they could have been supplied well for those bunkers had they been well thought out. But, you know, the French didn't bend food, didn't think they were going to have a problem either. Do you know where Dien Bien Phu is?
Yeah, North Vietnam, yes, sir.
Where in North Vietnam?
Real near the Laotian border.
Well, it's up, it's close to the Chinese border. It's up west of Hanoi.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's west of Hanoi, near the tri-border area, North Vietnam, Laos, and China.
Yeah, and I never knew where it was until I read a book on it this year.
Okay.
And amazing. French were the most arrogant I've ever seen in my life. They came in there, 200 miles, had to be supplied only by air.
Mm-hmm.
And remember Johnson, LBJ, and he said that he didn't want this to be any damn, well, I believe his words were goddamn Dien Bien Phu.
Mm-hmm.
We were, Khe Sanh is only about 40 miles from the coast.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you have a lot more air power, a lot more equipment, a lot more air defense. And there was no comparison on what the French set themselves up for.
Okay.
There's no comparison whatsoever.
Yeah. Well, did the tempo of your operations, did they, how were they affected over time, from the time you became a field battery commander until field platoon commander until you left? Did the tempo of operations change that much?
The tempo of operations. Well, the heaviest time of all was probably, the first 6-7 months of 68 still stayed active. It slowed down in the middle of 68. Then it started up again in the fall after that monsoon. And then shortly after I left, my battery that I was with was at Anh Hoa, but this is the month following when I left.
Mm-hmm.
And they had what they call a mini Tet of 69.
Mm-hmm.
And in trying to supply those, I believe we had one or two guns that were blasted out in that operation.
Mm-hmm.
And the helicopter was downed, and they even had a place to land a C-130 there, and they lost a C-130. And so that was one place that came under some heavy bombardment in late January of 69.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the month after I left.
Okay.
But we lost a lot of equipment from them.
Yes, sir. So, but it did pick up after the monsoon in the fall of 68, before you left.
Yeah, I started picking up again.
Okay. Now, what did you think about the way the war was being conducted from your view? And what did you think about what the United States was doing and trying to accomplish there?
Well, you have such a minuscule view. Of course, when I was in battalion, I had a little bit more information being there than I did when I got to the firing battery. And I had even a lieutenant colonel, looking back, had very little information to really tell him what he was going overall in the big picture. So I don't think anybody from a battalion level less, anybody from a division commander less, really had much information about the overall scope of it. And, of course, I've learned a lot more since I've been in the last few years than I ever knew then. And, we kept wondering when are we going to invade the North? I do remember when LBJ announced that he wasn't going to run again.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought in my mind, that's a chicken way out. Start all this and you aren't going to have guts enough to finish it. But I think one of his overriding concerns was probably his health. I don't know. But at least he served out his term, so I guess that's all that's required.
But that's you raise an interesting point, I think, the fact that here the president decides not to stay in the fight. Did that have any kind of an impact on your opinions or the opinions of your fellow officers on what the United States was trying to do there?
I don't think so, and everybody believed that Nixon was going to come in and be tough and win it instantly.
Mm.
We really believed that.
Okay, you believed in his secret plan to win the war?
Yeah, we really believed that Nixon was going to be able to do what he said.
Mm-hmm.
He'd do it better than LBJ.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, and you didn't have any time to experience any shift, except, of course, the in-country commander did change.
Yeah.
Westmoreland left, and Abrams took over.
Yeah, but Westmoreland did come back and visit the battalion in 71. There's a story on the web called Why South Vietnam Lost the War.
Okay.
And it's about a short paragraph written by one of our enlisted men.
Mm-hmm.
I got to tell you about it. It's real short. Anyway, Westmoreland comes in. They've been shooting all night, and next day here they are all grungy and been shooting all night, guarding the perimeter, and then Westmoreland flies in and tells this guy he needs a shave. And he says, I don't remember what else was said because I was so pissed. So the caption of it is, why South Vietnam lost the war.
Oh, goodness.
But that was after he was, what was he? He came back in a different capacity, just on a visit, and I can't remember what his capacity was.
Yeah.
It's part of the chiefs of staff something.
Yes, sir. He's the secretary.
The secretary of
the chairman of the Joint Chiefs.
Okay. Well, whatever it was, he came back over.
Yes, sir.
And there's a picture in there on the web when Admiral McCain came over and visited some troops. And there are these guys in the picture wearing red bandanas and looking sloppy and everything. I thought, my God. That would have never happened. We would have all been looking like soldiers when I was there. And here there are the admirals there, and they're looking like crap.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really true. It deteriorated, and the big brass tolerated it, but they may not have had a choice.
Yeah. What did the morale in your unit shift appreciably?
After I left, from what I've learned.
While you were there?
There was no drug problem whatsoever while I was there. I'm sure some guys smoked marijuana under my nose occasionally, but there was no drug problem, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
It got so bad by the late 70 and early 71 that they were having major problems.
Yes, sir.
And I've gotten documents where one of the first sergeants, he was a black first sergeant, and he locked up in a bunker, five or six of them. And some visiting guy had come up and says, maybe the congressman or somebody came out and said, here you have guys locked up in a bunker and all that. He said, let me show you what we got. And he showed it to him and said the guy almost left crying. It was such a pathetic scene. These were druggies if they were drying out.
My goodness.
And I couldn't, when they started telling me this, I wouldn't believe it. I said, you guys are just making it up. But apparently, 3 years later, it was absolutely a different world.
Hmm.
And I didn't even know that until a couple of years ago that it changed that much.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had told me our battalion ever had a drug problem, I wouldn't have believed it. But it ended up being just like any other unit.
Mm-hmm. And there were no racial problems?
Not while I was there. Now, we had one, I call it a minor deal. We had a black, very popular black sergeant. The black guys come in, they want to be in his gun platoon. Well, you know, keep them happy. Well, then they sort of mutinied on him. So we had to reintegrate.
Okay.
And, you know, that's just a common sense thing. They were taking advantage of him.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we got the proper mix, everything was back in order.
Okay.
But I didn't call that a real racial problem because it was some black troops abusing their own NCO.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about officer enlisted relationship? What was that like? Was there any tension? Of course, later in the war, in particular, infantry units, you hear about fragging incidents. And things
like we that. Didn't. Well, I'm going to tell you, we don't have this on the web, but we had our first battalion commander was a very popular West Point DS. I believe it's I can't remember if it's DSC or Silver Star, is a high award that he got in the Korean War,
mm-hmm.
and well respected. And then we had what we call one of the ticket punching.
Mm-hmm.
Battalion commanders had a reserve commission, came up through ROTC, and Martin's not probably worried about his career more than anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the type of guys that'd be firing all night in the mud. He'd come out and have them lay boards out to the guns, and then walk on the boards and just start chewing the gun crews out directly. Well, if you know anything about Army chain of command, the battalion commanders does not go out and chew out the gun crews.
No.
He goes to the officers and he lets them take it down the chain of command.
Right.
So he lost a lot of respect on that, and he got smoke fragged a couple of times.
Oh, no.
But we were more civil. They used smoke
frags. Right, smoke grenades, not real fragmentation grenades.
So but nobody really, I'm sure he got real upset about it, but nobody really gave that a second thought because all the officers say that son of a bitch deserves it.
Okay.
And he tried to get his sergeant major, mm-hmm. command sergeant major, court-martialed because he carried a 38 instead of a 45.
What?
And I'm not kidding you. The guy was an idiot.
Oh, my.
And then he was an idiot, and so...
Okay.
But then the other battalion commanders, the best I can determine, mm-hmm. he was the only one that didn't have any respect. We have one battalion commander that came in after I left named Ike Smith. He was mm-hmm. a black battalion commander
mm-hmm.
that became a two-star general and is probably the most popular veteran of the battalion, and mainly because if you make it to general, that means you're a very eloquent speaker and know how to really charm.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, you don't ever become general.
Yes, sir.
So at the reunions and all that, he's a popular speaker because he knows how to really lay it on thick.
Yes, sir.
And so everybody likes Ike.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I've talked to people that served under him. They said he was a tough battalion commander,
mm-hmm.
but he had everybody's respect.
Okay. Let's take another break. We've been talking for an hour and a half.
Okay.
This is Steve Maxer continuing the interview with Mr. Charles White on the 5th of March 2003 at 4 o'clock Central Standard Time. This is mini disc number 2 of the interview. Well, one of the other stories that you mentioned in the writings that you've done on your website involved Martha Ray.
And, yes.
And she's got quite a reputation of boosting the morale of troops in Vietnam. And I was wondering if you could just describe how it came about that she visited your unit and the effects that it had.
Yeah. Well, of course, most of the guys, all Martha Ray was very well known except for the one trooper that's mentioned. And very popular, and everybody was excited because those in the fire, out in the hills, unless they got leave to go back to the main location, would not ever get to see a main show. So, but Martha Ray would go everywhere. From what I've read, she went to every distant camp there was. Went to a lot of special forces camps even. And they'd give her a special forces hat, and, you know, she'd sit down and have a beer with them, and she was loved by them. I mean, this is, I don't have personal knowledge, it's just what I've read. And so everybody was really excited about Martha Ray coming. And so they flew in a little bubble helicopter, and it's a small one, and damn, I can't remember what it's called. Is it the OH-1 or something like that?
Was it the Loach?
Yeah, probably a Loach. Mm-hmm. She and Rob and her guitar player. I remember them flying in a little helicopter. And they built that little ammo box stage, Marines did, out of a 105 ammo crate. You probably, there's a picture of it in there in case you hadn't seen it.
No, I haven't.
Well, let me get you. Are you near a web?
No, I'm not. I don't have any computers in my office in this room. Sorry.
Anyway, we've got a picture of the. It's called. Well, let me pull it up so I remember what to talk about. Martha Ray on ammo box stage, and it shows the hills beyond the Quezon Valley on that stage,
mm-hmm.
where she is, and it's ammo box made out of 105 ammo boxes,
mm-hmm.
and it shows her and the guitar player and Rob and then the troops in a mm-hmm. circle around the little stage.
Mm-hmm.
And she came out there, and she's an excellent entertainer and told jokes, you know. A lot of them were crude, but they were funny as everything, and everybody loved her. And, you know, the guy that was disappointed, he ended up enjoying it a lot. And by the way, we have located that guy, and I know his name now.
The guy from Holland?
Yeah.
Okay.
His name was Peter J. Metz.
Okay.
We've talked to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives in... It's either Oregon or Washington now, but we've located him.
Mm-hmm.
It's amazing how many guys we've located. We've still got,
yeah.
For the 4-year period, we still have more to locate. But
and he was disappointed because you...
Well, initially, yeah, when he saw her.
You said, you asked him if he knew Raquel Welch, and he said, yeah, and you said, well, wait until you see Martha Ray.
Yeah, exactly.
So you set him up.
Yeah.
You set him up.
And there's one other story I've got to confess to.
Mm-hmm.
When I was... A reporter came out one time. That was when I was at Hill 34
mm-hmm.
For a while near Da Nang. A reporter came out there, and they were wanting us to do a perimeter M60 firing. Said, we don't put on phony shows for you. And they wanted a bunch of phony stuff. We refused. But they wanted an interview. And so I thought, you know, I think I'll just give them a real story. And I told them about all this Star Wars stuff they'd drop these things out of the planes, and they'd drop them down on trails, and there'd be people sniffers, and I made up the biggest, and that they'd have electronically the commands could fire the guns and all that, and I made up the biggest sci-fi story, and do you know that that was published in the Dallas Times Herald on August 28, 1960? I believe it's 28th or 31, sometime in that three-day time frame, 1968. Mm-hmm. It got published in the paper. Of course, the public didn't know it. None of it was, very little of it was true. A lot of it was. Mm-hmm. And do you know that now it's no longer fiction?
Now, what's this?
All that junk I made up back then, mm-hmm, is no longer fiction. We can do all that stuff. But I was embarrassed to find out that hit the newspapers. My wife cut a copy out and sent it to me, and I said, oh, my God, I didn't think they'd get in the paper. I thought she'd know better. And so I had to be more careful with my humor around reporters after that.
Mm-hmm. Did you get visited by many reporters?
That was the only one we met.
Okay.
And it was a... And anyway, I was a little bit... I was more careful about what I said around anybody after that. Mm-hmm. Of course, the commanders and the brass never knew about it. And people read it in Dallas paper probably didn't know the difference. So. Mm-hmm. But to an artilleryman, it was embarrassing. Fortunately, it didn't get published in the Stars and Stripes or anything, so
right.
No embarrassment.
So was that your principal source of news, the Stars and Stripes?
Mm-hmm.
Did you get other stuff from home?
Well, my wife would clip out. I got more information about what was going on, mm-hmm, from what my wife clipped out, sent to me from U.S. News and World Report and those type of deals. They'd have maps and drawings, and they'd even show where the NVA was located and where we were located and everything. I mean, it was amazing what they had printed there. Mm-hmm. Of course, I don't think they were giving away any U.S. secrets by publishing that. Well, they might have, but to the extent they were telling the world where we thought they were. Mm-hmm. They would show our units and where they thought the NVA units were and all that. They'd have it on those maps. As far as showing where we were, they already knew where we were. Mm-hmm. But for them to find out that where we thought they were might not have been very smart.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, I got a lot of information out of them.
Did you get a lot of letters?
My wife wrote me every single day.
Wow.
And there's one new story on the web by a lady that spoke at the reunion that was married at the time. And she said she swore that she would never write another letter in her life just for the sake of writing a letter when she didn't have anything to write about. And I know my wife got the feeling like that, too.
Yeah.
You know, you'd only talk about the same thing so many times over and over.
Okay.
And I wrote my wife most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
There was times that we couldn't write, but mm-hmm, I wrote her pretty good.
Okay. Now, as your time was drawing near to leave Vietnam, I was kind of hazy. I didn't know if you arrived in early January or late December 67 or early January 68.
Early January, but I'm showing my tour is 67-68 because I got credit for the diversion to Panama.
Gotcha. Okay, so that's why you leave. That's why you left in December of 68.
Left my unit. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. Are there any other stories or anything you want to discuss about your time in Vietnam before leaving?
I can't think of anything specific, really.
Okay.
That comes to my mind at the moment.
Did your attitude about the war change at all during the course of your...
No, I was still a hawk when I came back.
Okay. Did that ever change?
Well, I'm only a quasi-hawk right now.
Okay.
You know what I'm talking about?
Well,
I'm a little uncomfortable with this rack thing, but out of respect for the troops, I pretty well keep my mouth shut.
Okay. But in terms of... your feelings about the Vietnam War, though, and your thoughts about the Vietnam War, whether or not we either were justified in being there or did the right thing
we
were there?
Well, I think LBJ's heart was in the right place. I've always thought that.
Mm-hmm.
And Nixon was just trying to do the best he could.
Mm-hmm.
And so from that standpoint, and if you think back on history and the domino effect, Kennedy probably had us there too.
Mm-hmm.
Probably Goldwater. Probably all of them would.
Mm-hmm.
And looking back historically, you know, and we didn't learn very well from the French. It just, of course, we thought, well, the French weren't well supplied and all that. But you, if you got a dedicated enemy, mm-hmm. you can't win unless you go to the heart of it like we did in World War II. Mm-hmm. And I think we're finally learning that in history. And I hope the worst scenario I can think of is if we got in Iraq, and we get 50,000 troops gassed all at once, what are we going to do? You know what I mean?
Yes, sir.
And I don't think that would happen, but what if it did?
Right.
I mean, I really don't think they're going to fight to any great extent, the Iraqis, but if they do, mm-hmm. we're in a mess. We might be in a Somalia-type deal. But that's just off-the-cuff thinking.
Right. But you, in terms of your, when you left Vietnam, your
attitude, I was hawked in.
Yeah, your attitude about the war had not changed over the course of your tour there. What was it like leaving? Leaving your unit?
Oh, God.
Leaving your men behind?
Well, it's kind of funny. It's just exciting to leave, and it's the excitement of leaving just overwhelms the thought of leaving them there, you know. So long, suckers. We'll see you when you get back. And then I remember I went up to battalion headquarters, and this colonel that no one liked was there, and they gave me a plaque. I guess it's prepared by the 12th Marines. It has their logos on it, and it says 12th. It has the an army deal on the left. It has the 4th Artillery in the center and the 12th Marine logo on the right, and it says 12th Marines under it, and then it just says 1st Battalion, 4th Artillery, Dong Hong, Vietnam. Anyway, he gave me that plaque and mm-hmm. said, did you everything say? And I just said, well, said, I've had some times up here that were not so pleasant, and some times that were very fine, and that's all I said. And what is funny in my mind, when I said not so pleasant, I had a couple of run-ins with that colonel. I love the first one dearly, and this guy, I couldn't stand him. I was referring to him when I said not so pleasant, but they were thinking I was talking about my Vietnam experience, and I never gave it a second thought. And so fortunately, looking back, you know, I don't believe in burning bridges, so I don't think they took anything out of that comment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my cell phone's going off, but I'm not going to answer it.
Okay.
I did have some waltz on it or something. Wife didn't like it. It's got Reveille in there now, and that's kind of obnoxious, so I better change it to something else.
Well, when you did leave, what was the flight like leaving, and what was your arrival into the United States like?
Oh, gosh, and I bet you've heard this story 100 times when the plane lifts off the ground, you have the loud cheers and everything.
Mm-hmm.
I bet that's not the first time you've heard that.
No, sir. but it's good to hear.
It's quite an exhilarating feeling to mm-hmm. take off, and everybody's just an extremely jovial deal, and I thought there might be some harassing the stewardesses or something a little bit, but all the guys and gentlemen, but they had a lot of fun and everything. It was just a wonderful flight back. And so then we landed in Seattle. And you probably read the Dr. Hawkeye Pierce of 1968.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and describe what happened when you arrived in Washington, Washington State.
Well, when we arrived there, we went to the Pope's, and we had this plane load of men, and apparently all of them were in the group that were to be released from active duty at that time. There were enlisted men, there were doctors, there were guys like myself, and so we started walking around, and we couldn't find anybody there. Didn't know where to go, and we knew we were supposed to be processed out and released from duty, and so finally it's getting a little bit depressing. Couldn't find anybody, and then somebody stumbled onto a clerk, and he said, well, he'd called for us, and he came back and said, well, they don't have anybody to process y'all out. Y'all are going to have to stay here until after Christmas. And, you know, you can imagine what the guy said, like, hell we are.
Right, yeah.
And so this doctor, and he was the one who wore the tie, the only guy I ever saw did it, had FTA sewn on the back of it. And that did not mean future teachers of America.
No.
And if you were to pick a guy that matched Hawkeye Pierce
mm-hmm.
on the movie, he was a match
mm-hmm.
in attitude and everything that character portrayed.
Okay.
And so he calls up the general. Somehow he gets a phone number for the commanding general at the post, and I don't know how he got it. And it was just a few minutes that an NCO came out there and said, guys, says, we're going to start processing you out here right now. And y'all are head over this place. And I mean, just bang, 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 bang. Went over there and said, now y'all have to have a medical. Oh, you know, nobody want to have a medical. And so we got in there and started joking. Everybody said, well, you know, I can't pee. Is anybody, yeah, here, take some out of my bottle and all that. They pass them around and all that. Of course, that could be devastating this day and time.
It sure could.
So we got processed out, and then I went to the airport. And my wife had already bought me a plane ticket. So I was going on to get on the plane, and there were some black guys there, and they said, hey, you can't pull rank on us and get ahead of us. And I said, I just turned around. I said, you guys ever heard of reservations? We got on the plane, and I had carried back with me a trophy, SKS. It's a it's a predecessor to the AK-47.
Mm-hmm.
Fires the same round. And I had it with me legally, and I packed it in my baggage, took the stock off. And so anyway, I was never checked for that, never hassled, and just kept it and toted it all the way home.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't have the papers with it, if I should have been stopped. Now, I've heard these stories of guys being harassed and all that when I came back. I never saw any of that.
Okay.
The public was somewhat aloof to the situation, which I didn't think anything about it at this time. But I do know when I see an isolated soldier this day and time at the airport like that, excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
Excuse me, touched the nerve here. Don't be surprised if I don't hand him a $20 bill.
Okay. Do you want to take a break?
No, I'm good with that.
Okay. When, what was the reunion with your wife like when you arrived in Dallas?
Oh, gosh. Man, that was exciting.
Mm-hmm.
She was there at the front.
Mm-hmm.
And it was Christmas. And
mm-hmm.
You can't think of anything better.
No.
So that was wonderful. And then I was back in law school on January the 3rd after that.
Were you really?
I had a semester in law school, and rather than try to play deferments and all that, I just went ahead and went at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And I had taken some law books with me, and during the monsoon those times I'd done a lot of reading.
Okay.
So I was able to graduate first in my class from law school.
Wow.
And I attribute that to my Army experience and, you know, a little bit more maturity and all that. I don't think I could have done it if I hadn't have done the Army thing.
Because
there's a lot of competition.
Yes.
And it's not so much intelligent. Up to a point there is, but after that it's just who puts in the most effort.
Mm-hmm.
So from that standpoint, the Army was a good deal for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. When you got back, you went to school here in Texas, correct?
Mm-hmm.
Law school?
With the SMU.
SMU.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
Well, I had the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't have anything to spend my money on for a year. My wife was working.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, she got pregnant shortly after I got back.
Mm-hmm.
But with the GI Bill and what we'd saved up, what I could borrow, and a couple of scholarships, we got through law school without owing much money.
Oh, that's good.
At SMU.
Mm-hmm.
So, I remember there was a federal judge that had formed a scholarship that I ended up getting his scholarship. It wasn't much, but it paid tuition for a semester.
Okay.
For two semesters. And I thought that was real nice of him.
Mm-hmm. Very nice.
And then at SMU, there was several veterans there, and we'd always congregate and eat our sandwiches in the basement, and apparently SMU has some rich boys attending school, and they'd go off with eat at their restaurants or whatever during the day, but we had a lot of camaraderie at school.
Mm-hmm.
I do remember they had one big demonstration at SMU, and actually it wasn't a big demonstration. It was 8 students that had taken over the administration office with a list of demands that was popular during the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And there was 8 students, 2,000 spectators, and so the newspapers reported 2,000 demonstrators.
Oh, for crying out loud.
I'm serious.
Oh,
I've often wondered at Kent State how many of those were spectators and how many of them were demonstrators.
Right.
really wouldn't have any sympathy at all for those that got shot, except they could have been just spectators. And I got to think back, hell, I myself was a spectator in one of those things.
So the atmosphere there on the campus, I'm sure, was fairly conservative and not necessarily anti-war.
It was pretty, yeah, they didn't really have a position.
Okay.
I mean, we had a few liberals, but the liberals were gentlemanly and got along fine, so.
And there was no animosity shown towards veterans?
No, I've never seen one I've read all these stories about. I mean, there was a lot of people that were really strong, we shouldn't be there and all that, but as far as animosity to the veterans, I doubt sighted that was mainly in California.
Now, did you openly discuss your military experiences with people, or did you keep that to yourself?
Well, I didn't have many people asking, and I wasn't going to go around volunteering a bunch of stuff.
Okay.
And actually, for the next 30 years, it was something that seldom came up.
How was your adjustment to civilian life? I mean, you had a pretty rapid decompression and reintroduction into normal American
life. Yeah, I didn't have time to dwell on anything else, so that's probably good. Not having any time to dwell on anything but studying is good.
Do you think jumping into the strict regimen of law school helped you in that respect?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
Now, as far as, you know, you probably heard of guys being a little jumpy at explosions and incoming and all that.
Right.
And that is true to some extent for a short period. I do know that summer I came out to Texas, and they didn't warn me in advance that they were going to have that artillery ground burst simulator going off in the hills. Have you ever seen it at Paladura Canyon?
No, sir. I've been to Paladura, but I haven't seen that.
Yeah, it's a program they have, and they simulate lightning. They have an unexpected ground burst artillery simulator to go off in there. And I thought we'd been hit by incoming right then. But anything like that, about the time 69 was over, I don't have any problems.
Okay. Well, what did you think as the war came to a close and as the United States signed the Paris Peace Accords in January of 73 and then, of course, Saigon fell in April of 75?
Yeah. Well, let me back up a little bit then.
Okay,
In 1971, I read in the Dallas Times News that 33 men were killed in a bunker at our old location, and it was where my battery was. Is back. They had since moved up to a place called C1. And sure enough, it was that location. And it killed 33. The paper said 33. All we found out on the later reports, the guys are saying it was 29.
Okay.
And our guys were there. I'm telling you what I've learned since then. But we didn't have any guys killed in it. They were in there digging them out. But it was mainly from a neighboring Army unit. The Marines were gone from there by that time. And so they did dig out, they saw anywhere from 25 to 30 guys. And because most of them was caved in the bunker and all that. But anyway, I thought all those years until 2000, I thought that was our battery. I thought all those years, for 30 years, that we had lost 30 men in that one deal. But we were lucky. Seemed like we walked and drove in the right places most of the time at the right times, places. And anyway, that was disturbing. And that's probably when it really crossed my mind that we were probably needlessly losing some of our men. And so then the POW thing came on, and you know that really draws us. I still remember the sign. You're too young. But somebody held up a sign in the plane as the POWs were leaving Hanoi. It said, "Thank God and Nixon." And they plastered that all over the news. Of course, I'm sure Nixon reveled in it. And I don't hold animosity towards Nixon, as a lot of people do. Can you imagine trying to work with 400 people walking around the street screaming at you every day? It might be hard to maintain your sanity, and you might go off base a little bit, so I don't hold a whole lot of animosity to him. He probably should have started the bombing of Hanoi a couple of years earlier, and he'd have ended it, but, you know. know, he didn't really jump down and start doing it until he just finally gave up and said, we've got to do it. And that's what ended the war. When they finally said, we'll sign and you take your prisoners and we'll call it a draw. And, of course, I didn't feel like the South would be able to hold it very long. They held it 2 years longer than I thought they would. So, you know, it was nice to see it come to end. I've always resented, I believe it was Carter that pardoned the deserters. I've always resented that. Carter's probably the most moral president we ever had. But a little inept, things like grain embargoes and all that, he killed our economy out here anyway. And so he was not a good president, but probably the most moral one we had. But there's one thing he did I sure did resent, still resent.
Yes, sir.
I mean, he could have given them something just so they'd have the stigma of being a deserter. They didn't even have to be punished very much. So anyway, it was quite, to me, it was quite exhilarating to see those prisoners come home.
Yes, sir.
And I've got another story on there. It's probably not under my name. When we got Hanoi Jane blocked from speaking against the American Bar Convention.
No.
You're not familiar with that?
No. Were you active in doing that?
I'm the one that started it and got it done.
Okay.
It's a story on there. It's probably indexed under New York Times.
Okay. So you heard that she was going to be a speaker?
Well, she came out in the American Bar Journal. She was going to be a speaker at the awards dinner.
Mm-hmm.
All right. I found out why. Clinton was a buddy to a guy named, the president of the American Bar at that time was a guy named Philip Anderson, who Clinton worked for at one time. And I really think Anderson scheduling her was just kind of his last chance to slap back at the Vietnam veterans, is what I think. Anyway, they scheduled her, and so I had gotten, I knew there was a former POW lawyer in Houston by the name of Robert Bliss, so I emailed him. And I said, we're finding Hanoi Jane speaking at the American Bar Journal Association as an honored guest in 1999. This is the first time I really ever thought about Vietnam for almost 30 years. See, well, 99, yeah, that'd be 31 years. First time I had even thought about Vietnam to mount anything, and when that came across, it didn't bother me so much because my kids have watched her exercise tapes and all that, and I said, that's okay. But to have her sitting in an American Bar Association speaker position, which generally you wouldn't have an actress speaking to them anyway.
No.
I thought it was unforgivable.
Yes, sir.
So I emailed Bliss a message and said, are you aware of this? That I am fighting this. Can I get the support of your law firm? We're talking about Fulbright and Jaworski, which was at one time the biggest law firm in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
He's still with them, by the way. And I get an email back from him. He says, this cannot happen. He says, I'll get back with you. So his next email, he says, the firm cannot support it as a firm, but we're free to individually support it. Well, he had some partners. One of them was a former ABA president. And they supported him. And apparently he had wide support from his firm. So I was emailing back and I said, we're starting a national letter writing email campaign. Can we use you as our, I don't think he used the word poster boy, but that's what the context of it was at. And he wrote back and he said, yes. So we started this throughout the country, and ABA had an email address, and we started bombarding them completely. And doctors, we got a lot of help from the medical profession because so many draftee doctors. Didn't get a lot of support from the apathetic lawyers, really. They were afraid they'd make a client mad or something. But also the ABA, the Texas bar president was a friend of mine from Farwell at that time named Charlie Acock. And he attended the convention afterward, and he gave me a little feedback. Said my name was mentioned at the convention. But anyway, so my wife and I was desperate to get him back. Cause I said, you send your own email in there and tell them it's got to stop and all that. So she emailed him in July of 99. Early July, and then a week later she got a message back that says, please be advised that Jane Fonda has a scheduling conflict and cannot speak in the record, that she will be replaced by somebody else. And so then I got a call from the Boston Globe, and they wrote an article on it. I got a call from several newspapers, but we didn't have the story we really wanted written. So I called a editor in Fort Worth named L.B. Abby.
Mm-hmm.
Levy. Levy, L-A-B-B-E. She's a conservative, a columnist. And she had written veterans articles. And so I told her, I said, we need a story written on this. Now, the one that's on the web is the New York Post article. It was the first one coming out. But anyway, I told Levy, I said, if we can get you, will you write an article on this? Says, we will get you a live interview with one of the POWs who's a member of the American Bar Association. She said, really? I said, we can do it. And I'd already cleared this with Bliss first. And so she talked to me for a while, and then she talked to Bliss. And when she wanted to interview me about Vietnam, basically the article just says I didn't have want to say anything about my stuff in Vietnam. And so, because, and my reason was for that, because I wanted the article to center around Bliss. Because, so she interviewed Bliss. Well, now she did quote me saying that, it's always a conflict, scheduling conflict when American veterans get involved or something like that. She quoted me on that. But the story is about Bliss and, the AB campaign and us coordinating the write-in and all that. And, anyway, supposedly ABA spokesman made a statement. Well, they hadn't had much complaints. That there hadn't been many to complain. And she said White said that there's something amiss there because he'd received copies of hundreds of emails sent to the American ABA.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, she wrote a real nice article about Bliss. I've got that somewhere here, but mm-hmm. the one that's on the web is the New York Post article,
okay.
which quotes me and Bliss.
Who ended up being? I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, who ended up being the speaker that year at the ABA convention?
Let's see. The speaker was, let me see.
I didn't know if it was on the top of your head, if you knew.
Well, I've got it right here, didn't I? See, it was replaced by CNN news anchor Judy Woodruff.
Okay.
Now, the next year, the ABA elected an ex-Korean Marine veteran, or a Marine Korean, veteran of the Korean War.
Right, a Marine Corps veteran.
So it kind of got its head a little bit screwed back on straight.
Okay.
But it still takes a lot of, jumps in a lot of things that I don't think has a business. I'm a member still. Oh, I wrote them when I started. I said, a lot of lawyers, when they get in this situation, they cancel their membership. I said, be advised that I will not cancel my membership, but you'll wish like hell I did. And there was a general, I got a letter from a general, retired general from Georgia, and he had said the same thing, said he'd been tempted to resign his membership, but he wasn't going to let him get away that cheap. It was a veteran, Vietnam veteran, retired general as a member of the ABA, which I didn't know at the time. But it was a fun project, but up until 99, I had basically ignored it, had not kept in contact, had never met or talked to anybody with the unit except the one guy I mentioned who became the FBI agent. So it was exciting from then on.
Right.
And that's when we went on the web, and in 2000 we started finding some guys, looking for each other.
What do you think about the way the United States has handled its relationship with Vietnam since 1975? In particular, Clinton's normalization of relationship.
That's one thing that I agreed with Clinton on.
Okay.
He did a good job on that. And I think most veterans, if there's many veterans that are opposing, I'd be surprised. We have one guy in the battalion, and he has a story on there where he is personally financing a school or an orphanage near Dong Ha.
Mm-hmm.
And he describes when he went up there. And the title of the story is called Enemies No More. And if you don't mind me just telling you a little bit of that story.
Yeah, go ahead.
He says that he took his son with him and is in a cemetery. He starts out to the cemetery north of Dong Ha. 40,000 graves, and he wonders how many of Alpha batteries were how many of them were killed by Alpha battery. And he said it was really depressing. And while he's there, he said a busload or a load of men drive up, and so his guide identifies that as being former North Vietnam soldiers. And so he says, said he was well armed. He had several rolls of colored, several rolls of black and white, but no heavy stuff. Mm-hmm. And he had his son wait nearby, and he goes up there, and here they are facing each other, and they know he's an American, and they know that he's probably a former veteran because those are the only guys that ever show up there. So you have these North Vietnamese soldiers and a former American soldier at a standoff there. He says the silence is intense, you know. So he sticks out his head and says, enemies no more. And he said they just went berserk. They all wanted their picture taken with him, and said it was one of the most friendly receptions he'd ever had. Very touching story.
Yes, sir.
And he has pictures on it and all that. It's a wonderful story on there called Enemies No More.
Mm-hmm.
And he's the one that's sponsoring the orphanage.
Okay.
I don't know if it's not an orphanage, it's a school
at
Dong Ha, but he's personally financing it. He's a cabinet builder or something, or cabinet and doors up in Minnesota or somewhere.
Hmm.
But we've had some class guys come out of this.
Yes, sir.
And there was a Marine Lieutenant Colonel from a friend of mine here in Amarillo that commanded a company over there. And he, same time, and he had the experience of losing, oh gosh, over 50 men in one incident. And we're talking about a fourth of his company in one operation. And he went over there it'd be last year now. And he went from the Delta clear up to Dien Bien Phu, and I told him to take pictures. And so he gave a speech at our Lions Club, and he really loved his trip. Says they love Americans, said most of them are too young to even remember the war. Said, but they still hate the French, universally across Vietnam, north and south. They love Americans, but they hate the French.
Mm-hmm.
But he said because of their communist situation, says they're a little bit apprehensive to talk too freely, you know, and but said that the general people will still really like Americans. He said all those graves that you see are North Vietnamese soldiers, that the graves of South Vietnamese soldiers were all plowed under and unrecognizable. So to the victor goes the spoils, I guess. But anyway, he went all the way over to Hanoi and all that, and then, but he spent, ironically, with all of that, most of his program was devoted to his photographs that he took of the mountain people in the mountain regions that didn't have anything to do with the war.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that was his interest now. He said he wasn't going to dwell on the guys he'd lost over there. He'd gotten over that a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a fascinating speaker, and it's the first time I've heard credible firsthand information that they really like Americans. Of course, they like our money. But still, though, I somehow think that the Vietnamese realized that we weren't over there in a colonialist role like the French.
Right.
And somehow, I personally, or at least I'd like to think, that at least we thought we were doing the right thing.
Yes, sir. Have you been back yourself?
No.
Do you want to go back?
Sort of, but I've got so many places I'd like to go.
Okay.
I've got to go to the Amazon and back to Panama and some other places, too, but I would like to go someday.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not a top priority for me. Yeah. I've enjoyed reading the stories of the other guys that have went.
Yeah. Well, what do you think about the Agent Orange controversy that's emerged from the war?
Well, you know, it's the same stuff our cotton farmers used for years, and I hadn't seen too many ruined by it.
Mm-hmm.
So I think a lot of it's pumped up, just like I do PTSD. I see a lot of guys, I know some that are faking it and drawing 100% disability. I resent that.
Yes,
I have met Bataan Death March soldiers that unquestionably had it and never got over it.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you've seen real cases of it,
mm-hmm.
And you see a guy that served at a headquarters company somewhere near Saigon and getting 100% disability, like one I'm referring to, it really gets my craw.
Yes, sir.
Now, we have some of our battalion that's drawing a percentage, but not 100%. And but then we have the guys, we have a couple of them on 100% disability, the ones spent the 2.5 years in the hospital. Those and amputees, I'd rather reward them higher than letting others that would have probably been losers regardless. Don't get me wrong, there's some that have problems, but I think they're rare, and there's a TV program came over, and it's made a lot of vets mad, but had a lot of truth in it, you know, about the phony claims.
Yes, sir.
Now, back to Agent Orange, I think there's a little bit of the same thing. But on the other hand, I could be wrong. And so I don't.
Did they defoliate much around where you operated?
Yes, they did, and I don't know of anybody that's scientifically been connected to it. You know, they come out, and I believe they said anybody that served over there and has prostate cancer, they're going to regard it that, which that's okay if they want to just throw that in as an additional veteran's benefit. That's okay. But I worry that there's some that are, well, you know what I'm talking about when I'm talking about cotton defoliation in the same way.
Yes, sir, I do. Yes, I do.
And, you know, those guys have the probably the same exposure or more exposure.
Yes, sir.
And so...
Every year.
Every year, they've been doing it for a lot, even before Vietnam.
That's right.
So so I have that experience to equate with it, you know. And I don't know how many people have really equated that with the agriculture situation. If I hadn't been around cotton and all that, I might think differently.
Do you think the government's taking good care of its veterans?
Well, yes and no. The VA, I've had several cases, death cases against the VA. Their incidence of medical errors in Amarillo, for example, is more than the medical community combined. I've had one guy that walked in on his own 2 feet, have a cervical neck disc removal infusion, and woke up a quadriplegic for life. And I've had a guy that walked in with back pain on his own 2 feet, and they gave him a dose of morphine. It was 22 times the accepted dosage, and he died before morning. And I've had a guy that went in for one-day surgery, which is what is pending right now. It ended up in 3 months in the hospital, and they penetrated his gut, and they didn't find it out. And finally, the family took him out and moved him to a private hospital. And then they were able to save his life, but he was almost dead. So that part of it, and I think a lot of that is traced to the fact that they are hiring too many doctors that barely speak English.
Foreign doctors?
Yes.
Is it because they could pay them less?
Oh, I'm sure it is.
My goodness.
I had rather, and I have another guy that went in complaining about rectal bleeding, and he saw the nurse practitioner for 9 months, at which time they decided maybe they ought to do a colonoscopy. And it was too far gone, and they had to permanently take out his anus and his colon, and he has to use a bag for the rest of his life. And if you were in a private hospital seeing a private physician and all that, they wouldn't let you go 9 months with those symptoms without testing you for that basic procedure. And so I'd rather see them probably just have more of a federal health Medicare-type insurance. It'd probably be better served, but they've got these facilities. And, you know, maybe just qualify them for early Medicare insurance would be the same thing. Wouldn't it?
I don't know. I'm not an expert enough in this in the system, but I certainly understand your point. Of course, the VA medical system is immense. It's a huge bureaucracy.
Well, and now... guys go in, they can't get, now unless they, now if they're a Purple Heart or something like that, they can qualify for early, but otherwise they're on a long waiting list to start getting treatment. Right. Now I went in and got a card just because I want to use a different card for identification on the airlines. But I wouldn't use them.
So it's a photo ID you can use.
Well, you can, except Southwest last time wouldn't recognize it. I sat there and argued. I said, well, this is federal. You're relying on a state license. This federal one has a picture on it. It should carry more clout and everything. You know, remember the supremacy clause under the Constitution? Said, we don't care. Produce your driver's license.
Oh, that's funny.
And but most of the time they'll use that as ID.
Okay.
And so anyway, I just did that for something different.
Yeah.
And I quit arguing with them. I just bring my driver's license and I produce both of them, let them decide what they like.
Well, so you have a rather interesting perspective on the VA system and how it's handling veterans.
Well, of course, I'm only talking about the Amarillo installation.
Right.
But now when you go out there, their staff is so polite and nice to people.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just either they may be understaffed, maybe they're understaffed or something, because the personnel is certainly nice.
Mm-hmm.
And they've got the nursing home, which, mm-hmm. as far as I know, it's pretty nice.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a needed thing, the nursing home in particular.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe they'd be better off to convert it to nursing homes and use just a Medicare, put them on Medicare early,
mm-hmm.
for the guys that really need the help.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, if you aren't, basically, if you make over $20,000 a year, you aren't going to qualify out there for any cut rate treatment anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And to get your card, you don't even have to fill out their financial statement if you make over $20,000. So just forget it. You get your card, but you're going to pay the regular rate,
right.
Which is okay.
Mm-hmm.
I just wouldn't have surgery there, that's all.
Mm-hmm.
And I would check the prescriptions. I got them at their narcotics.
Mm-hmm.
And so, there was one more I had that they had a resident to do cataract surgery on this guy and messed it up, and they never told him they were using a resident from Texas Tech to do it. This was happening at Big Spring.
My goodness.
And, see, they don't, since it's federal, they don't have to have a Texas license.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't all have Texas medical license. A lot of them have them from other states.
Mm-hmm.
I think all of them have a medical license or something of some kind. But they do rely a lot heavier on nurse practitioners than the private medical sector.
Do you know that as far as the association? Now, is this the battalion association?
Uh huh. We formed it in 2000.
Okay. How many members are there now?
We have located 770, and probably half of those have actually joined,
okay.
paying dues.
Mm-hmm.
But if they show up at the reunions, then we'll get the rest of them next time, because we're going to have a reunion in Branson, Missouri next time.
Okay.
And then in 2006, it's going to be in Lawton, Oklahoma, because we're going to be the first Vietnam artillery unit to have a memorial there put up by the artillery unit, which we're working on getting funded.
Oh, that's excellent.
And so we're going to be real proud of that.
Yes, sir.
And
mm-hmm.
go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, of the members of your association now, do a lot of them take advantage of the VA hospital system?
I think they do. We have several that are drawing partial or some drawing total disability.
Okay.
There is one story, it's one of the saddest I've heard.
Mm-hmm.
It was a guy that served under me.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a real tough-looking guy, but he was a wonderful soldier. And after I left, he was going with a forward observing team in a helicopter that got shot down by an RPG as they were landing. He got burned, and he and one of our lieutenants spent maybe up to a year in a burn hospital in San Antonio.
Mm.
And then he moved back to New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And 6 years ago, he had a stroke that's left him paralyzed, or where he confined to a wheelchair with a paralyzed right arm,
mm.
and speech impairment, and virtually impoverished. And it's just one of the saddest things I've ever seen in my life. We've sent him the certificate, and we've paid his dues, and sent him the ball cap and the coins and all that. But when you talk to him, I can get a little bit out of him, but basically end up having to talk to his wife to get real information.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a real sad ending.
Yes, sir.
But, I mean, that happened to anybody,
yes,
veteran
sir.
Or not.
Yes, sir.
But there he goes, though. He's the guy that spends a year in a burn unit and then ends up like that on something totally unrelated.
Unbelievable.
The other guy that was burned, the lieutenant, he's a businessman up in the Midwest somewhere, and he's doing fine. But anyway, it's ironic how some things come out sometimes.
Yes, sir. Well, mm-hmm. Go ahead.
a guy dealt a hard deal over there and then end up getting a worse deal.
Mm-hmm.
Something totally unrelated.
Yes, sir. Well, how would you say the war affected you most personally?
Well, you know, when you think back, some of the trivial problems of life that you see so big now are not as big if you think back. Because when you're sitting there worried about that incoming coming in, which is damn, if anybody says they weren't scared of it, they're liars. That is the most frightening thing to be around. And of course, as an officer, you got to pretend to be unfazed. But God, it was scary. And so you don't have to worry about, excuse me, I'm eating a med here. Mm-hmm. I didn't mean to be chewing on.
It's okay.
You got to, well, anyway, sometimes it helps you put things in proper perspective. Things could be worse.
Yes, sir.
Which then takes me back to the basics. I remember my grandmother had a plaque on the wall that said, I used to complain because I had no shoes until I met a man who had no feet.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you put all that together, my grandmother knew about it best way back there.
Yes, sir. When did you have a very religious upbringing?
Moderately so. I went to church mm-hmm. and all that. I will say this. I personally thought that religion was bad for the morale. If you're being shelled all the time and then you're sitting in there having religious services, these guys start thinking about themselves and they get sad.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to keep their minds more active on something else. And mm-hmm. I really thought religion was bad for the morale.
Mm-hmm.
If you think, because they start pitying themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And I could sense it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I could sense it, I know they were sensing it. If you start self-pitying yourself in religious services when you're having those solemn moments
are
terrible. I remember attending a battlefield service that the 1st Cav had on operation. When it's called Operation Pegasus.
Mm-hmm.
They lost a few men. They had a battle service there where you stick the rifle on the ground and put the helmet on it.
Right.
I have decided that was the worst thing they could ever do. It's honoring their men, but it was horrible for morale.
Hmm.
I know our guys, if they were evacuated, that was it. I mean, you wrote the letters to the parents, but you didn't keep reminding your guys of it.
So you didn't have memorial services for guys that were that were killed?
No.
Okay.
Not when I was there. They did later.
Okay.
And then maybe it was our old salty battalion commander that thought like it did. Maybe he thought it would be bad for morale.
Mm-hmm. How many men were killed while you were there in your unit? Did you lose any men in your platoon?
When I was at the Dong Ha, we lost four in that one instance when
okay.
I was there, the round that went over me.
Okay.
And I was never close to any groups where we lost any men after that.
Okay. And for those four men that were lost, that were killed, there wasn't a similar memorial service with the rifle
stuck
in
there? There was no more memorial service, no.
Okay.
And I remember helping author a couple of letters to the families back home.
Mm-hmm.
We had a young West Point captain who was just really upset about it. I remember helping him
yeah.
go through the letters, but
yes,
he was really bothered by it.
Yes, sir.
And but we had no memorial service.
Did chaplains frequently come out to visit the troops? Or did they come out at all?
I never saw a chaplain.
The entire time you were in Vietnam?
I think I saw one time when I went back to Da Nang.
Okay.
But I know we didn't have a battalion chaplain. There was I'm sure that the 12th Marines had a chaplain somewhere, but he never came over to see the Army folks.
Mm-hmm.
But,
so you didn't have regular Sunday services that you could attend?
There was a place at Dong Ha you could go to mm-hmm. a Marine service.
Okay.
And, it was shelled every Sunday and had holes in it.
Oh, for crying out loud.
So it was not well attended.
No, I would imagine.
I remember I have pictures of it that had holes in it, you know, and nobody wants to go to that.
Oh, my.
And so I don't think it was well attended at all.
Okay.
And then when I was with B Battery, mm-hmm. if you were at the hills, you didn't have any that there was a place to go for services. I just never knew where they were, and not many guys attended. Now, that doesn't mean that the guys weren't religious. I think most guys were religious.
Okay.
And there's another story in our, if you want to talk about religion, we've got the story, it's called The Ambush, and it's when one of our teams got ambushed on Route 9. It's the one going from Quezon to Dong Ha. We had a team, a group that was ambushed on that, and it's called Ambush.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of comical. It's one of the, the reason I like the story is because it's so brutally honest. You have a young guy who was a battery clerk, and generally clerks are not that accustomed to action, and they're caught in an ambush. And he gets over in the bushes, and he thinks he's the only one alive. And he says he gets down, he's saying the Lord's Prayer over and over. And since somebody stumbles in, he thinks it's the enemy, and it's one of his buddies. And he says, what do you do? He says, I don't know about you, but I'm saying the Lord. And said, I'm praying. So he joined me.
Oh, no.
You know, instead of giving a real heroic story, they kind of, it's kind of a brutally honest story, you know, about the fear that these guys are in. In fact, that's the very first story. It's listed on that story set.
Okay.
Ambush between Dong Ha and Camp Carroll,
mm-hmm.
by Doug Shiflett.
There are
and
no...
Shiflett's another guy that's done real well afterward.
Yeah.
And, it's, let me see, what is it? The firing mortars continued for what seemed hours. Somehow I lost contact with everyone and didn't know what direction to head. I was laying on my stomach in a tall grass saying the Lord's Prayer over and over. I thought I was the only one left alive. A few minutes later, someone was running near me, and I thought it was the NVA. The person tripped over me. I looked up. It was John Shea. He was in a panic mode and asked me what we were going to do. I told him I was going to lay flat and keep praying. John joined me. So you don't see many stories like that.
No.
And so I thought, this guy is telling an honest story, because I see so many that I know are exaggerated with a little bit of heroism. And so, this guy is brutally honest.
Mm-hmm. Well, did the war affect your religious beliefs at all?
I can't say that it did.
Okay.
I learned something recently. My mother and dad were not particularly religious, but apparently got that way to the extent I thought they'd gone super religious when I came back from Vietnam. In fact, my mother and dad were totally changed. They were so religious that it really got on my nerves a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's totally different. And it stayed that way till her death.
My goodness.
And his, my mother died this last November.
Mm-hmm.
And my dad died 2 weeks later.
Mm-hmm. I'm very sorry.
In December. Mm-hmm. And before he died, he told me he prayed for me every day while I was in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Said, I'll tell you why he came back safe, and he told me that. And then we got a Christmas card from one of their friends. It was an old Texas Aggie. And I called him to tell him they both died within that month.
Mm-hmm.
And he started talking to me. He said, well, I want you to know that when you were in Vietnam, said, we got together and prayed for you every single day. So I thought that was real, real impressive.
Yes, sir.
It changed them. It didn't change me.
Okay.
But from the standpoint of a parent,
mm-hmm.
when Desert Storm was going on, I know I had a friend that had two sons in the Marine Corps
mm-hmm.
lined up in Kuwait, and I was just convinced we were going to lose 10,000 Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And it bothered the hell out of me.
Yes,
didn't seem to bother him. And, you know, as we came out, the Air Force and the rear went and took the biggest hickey.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first time I realized, from the perspective of a parent, what it could be like.
Yes, sir.
Darren, you have to excuse me. I don't know why I'm getting like this. Usually not.
You want to take a few minutes?
No, I'm doing fine.
Okay.
I've seen you probably cross this before.
Oh, yes. Well, one more big question from me. What do you think we as a nation should take away from the Vietnam War?
Well, We should have learned it from the French, but it's basically two things. Don't get into a fight. Well, let me give you an example. I, as a young lieutenant, I was trying to enforce a minuscule deal, and I was told by a senior officer, he said, if you ever provoke one of these, you better make it a good one, because if you do it on a small one, then you aren't able to carry through with it, so you're going to be embarrassed. Says, so don't ever take severe action unless you've got a slam dunk and it's going to stick and it's not going to embarrass you. I thought that was good advice. Mm-hmm. I can also apply that same rule to the highest level of politics. And we need to learn that you don't get into a conflict unless you intend to win it and win it quickly. George Bush made that very clear in Desert Storm. I think it's probably Colin Powell that decided not to go all the way to Baghdad, but I'm not going to fault him on that because I don't think our mission was designed to go beyond solving what the United Nations had authorized. Mm-hmm. So he handled that one correctly as far as his mission was concerned. Mm-hmm. Second one is somebody's got to start telling John Q. Citizen we may have the biggest firepower in the world. But it's not very smart to end up being the minority in the world because we're outnumbered severely. Mm-hmm. And you can't fight them all even though you've got all the nukes. Mm-hmm. And so the Iraqi thing, while I don't oppose it, it does bother me. And I don't know many veterans are saying that or not, but I'm not being vocal about it, but it does bother me somewhat.
Yes,
sir. So that's part of that lessons of history, mm-hmm. that we've got to learn that we have a place on this earth, but we are limited in manpower, and we can't go solve everything Somalia style. I use that as an example of the movie you probably saw, Black Hawk Down.
Yes, sir.
Great movie.
Mm-hmm.
And some great lessons we learned in that. And if we get into Iraq and they decide to fight, we're in that same mess. If we decide to take on the whole world, we can't win. Hitler learned that. Although he's the devil, I don't think we're... Some people try to compare our administration to that, but I think their heart's in the right place.
Yes, sir.
So I just want us to be wise, and that's the lesson we need to learn out of all that. And I thought we'd had pretty good training in that, but... you've always heard somebody say, oh, we ought to go just nuke them and solve the whole problem.
Mm.
That would not be very smart. And by the way, speaking of history, I don't know if you know it, but in Dien Bien Phu, the French were very upset at Eisenhower because he refused to go nuke the Vietnam for him.
Right.
For them.
Right.
So I don't have a lot of respect for the French either. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about?
No, it seems like we've talked a long time, doesn't
it? We have. It's been...
I don't know if you had all the... Well, you've probably done this a few times and have the questions already outlined, but it's obviously you made an interview outline before we started on this.
Yes, sir.
And I know most of these things are always done from the perspective of the infantryman, and I just kind of thought, well, we need an artilleryman's perspective, too. Because the roles were different.
Mm-hmm.
And... The big thing was, though, that even though the roles were different, and I'm going to emphasize one thing, they did not train our cannoneers
mm-hmm.
for their personal defense
right.
because people didn't realize they were the front line a big part of the time at most fire bases.
Hopefully they've improved that since then.
Yeah. Now, there's a book, if you haven't read,
mm-hmm.
that's called the... I believe it's called The Life and Death of Firebase Marianne.
Okay.
That was part of the AmeriCal, the old AmeriCal division,
mm-hmm.
which I think is actually the 23rd Infantry Division. Mm-hmm. Same division that Kelly came out of,
mm-hmm.
which was literally overrun and virtually wiped out. And, of course, their artillerymen were the big portion of that firebase. That was in 1970 or 71. And I do know reading stories that our battalion, when they received reports of that, they changed their attitude significantly
okay.
about how they were going to protect the troops.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, this is something I had covered. Since 1999, because, well, thanks to Jane Fonda, I have done a lot of reading. And we put our association together. We found me every week is meeting some of our guys.
Oh, that's great.
And I had a guy to come on the other night, this week, last weekend. Mm-hmm. I was the first guy he talked to since Vietnam in the battalion.
Wow.
And the guy's just ecstatic.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one reason I do that. That's so exciting.
Now, when is your next reunion?
In June 2004.
Okay.
We've been doing them every other year. Right. I guess if we get old enough, we might have them every year. But.
And that was going to be in Branson, Missouri?
Branson, Missouri. The last two were at Fort Sill, Oklahoma.
Okay.
And they had one in 96, but it's only just a, like 12, because they hadn't found anybody. That was before the Internet had gotten going.
Mm-hmm.
And at Fort Sill, and of course I was disappointed because I didn't know about it. So they really didn't have a real reunion until 2000. There's one thing I might mention. In year 2000, we went to the reunion at Fort Sill,
mm-hmm.
and we were the guests at a parade ground ceremony, and we were the largest groups there with our identifying ball caps. And the commanding general gave a speech, and he welcomed the mayor and the dog. Well, I'm exaggerating. Dog catcher, and everybody could mention. He never mentioned our battalion, and boy, our guys were furious. And there was one guy that brought his daughter there with him and everything, and he was so disappointed when he went home. So this 2002, we went there,
mm-hmm.
and I mean that commanding general, he poured it on thick. Afterward, the mayor came on and gave us a speech, and I talked to him later, and I said, "Mayor, you didn't have to say all that, but we sure appreciate it." And he said, "I mean it from the bottom of my heart,"
mm-hmm.
and he did. And so it was a great experience.
Mm-hmm.
And then they had a ceremony afterward. They had a sponsoring battalion, and they gave our guys representing our group at that time, we had a retired battalion commander, one of their coins. They're doing these little unit coins. And so first we gave them one of ours, and they pulled one out. Oh, I remember as our two-star general was retired, he gave him the battalion commander. He says, "Here's our coin." And says, "Next time I see you, I expect you to have one with you. And he turned around, he pulled one that's slightly larger out of his pocket, and he said, "General, here's ours, and next time I see you, I expect you to have a copy of ours." And anyway, it was a fun ceremony.
Mm-hmm.
And that particular unit is now in Kuwait, getting ready for the supposed invasion.
What?
It's the 2nd and 4th Artillery. Which is Tommy Frank's old battalion.
Okay.
And, but it's no longer a 105 unit. It's a, what they call MLRS rocket artillery
mm-hmm.
unit.
Okay.
But they're powerful.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting that we have Frank's old artillery unit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Frank's made me mad on one thing on the Afghanistan deal. He's on there on one of these interviews, and they're asking him how come they didn't have artillery and a bunch of stuff like that. And Franks gets up and says, "Well, I never knew much about artillery, but," I thought, that lying son of a gun.
Oh, for crying out loud.
And so I guess when you get to be general, you forget everything you learned, which I didn't play that at all.
No.
But it is interesting that you have an OCS-made officer like myself to be a general in a top position like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's one more thing I want to tell you before I leave.
Okay.
On that website, if you've got that HTTP, 8th mm-hmm. Battalion, 4th Artillery website,
yes, sir.
There is a deal on there. It says, "Letter from the Chief of Army Chief of Staff to the 8th Battalion." Whoops, that didn't come on. I don't know what happened. Well, I'll be darned. I'm drawing a blank on that. I'll have it fixed, but it's not opening. But it's a copy
mm-hmm.
of the letter. And I don't know why. Huh. That link is not working. But anyway, the Army Chief of Staff, Shinseki,
mm-hmm.
wrote us a letter for the battalion reunion and basically congratulating us for the, and it's dated the day before, congratulating us for our service in Vietnam and during hard times and all that, and politically unpopular times. And it was a well-appreciated letter. Of course, isn't he? Now he is not just the Army, he's on the Joint Chiefs now.
Right.
And so, in fact, I'm not sure what he is on the Joint Chiefs.
Shinseki?
Yeah?
I think he's the chairman now.
That's what I thought. Okay, so we got Shinseki, the letter from Shinseki just last summer to address to our battalion, and now he's chairman of Joint Chief Staff, so that's a letter we're proud of. So anyway, I guess I've talked enough. And,
well, thank you. Let me put an official ending on this. Thank you very much.
Okay.
This will end the interview with Mr. Charles White.